You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Sarah Williams Goldhagen. She is a contributing editor at Architectural Record and served as the architecture critic at The New Republic from 2005 to 2013. Her articles have appeared in The New York Times, American Prospect, Art in America. She's contributed essays to many publications, Assemblage, the Harvard Design Magazine, the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians, and her new book we'll be discussing is Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Sarah Williams Goldhagen, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you on. So I take the general idea behind this book to be that architecture and built environments in general are a much bigger factor and have a much greater impact on our lives, our mental health, our physical health, then we realize or pay attention to. Does that sum it up?
Yes, that does sum it up. And although there are certain aspects of that statement, that general statement that people have known and some people are more sensitive to than others, what's different now is that we have concrete evidence across a range of scientific studies showing just how profound the built environment and the environment in general, how profound an impact it is and what a profound role it plays in all sorts of ways that really almost no one could possibly imagine, as well as ways that they could. I mean, who knew that if you were placed to recover from surgery in a room that had a window to a brick wall, you would fare worse in terms of felt pain and healing than if you were across the hall in a room that had a view out to a pastoral landscape?
Well, to play devil's advocate a little bit, I would guess a number of people might have said they had a strong preference and thought they were doing better in the room with the view, but they might have been dismissed as being romantic and aesthetic and not having good evidence for their claim, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say that people would know that they preferred it. I can't think that they would imagine that they would heal 30% more quickly, by being in one place versus another. But it's the degree to you know, people know, okay, you know, you walk into a cathedral, wow, it's soaring, it's cool, my spirits are uplifted. Sure, everybody knows that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What they don't know is how profound those effects are physiologically, psychologically, in terms of the way it shapes our behavior. And what they don't know is how profoundly negative poor built environments have an impact on us, because people tend to think of the built, they sort of bifurcate the built environment into high architecture, like fancy buildings, museums, whatever, and then what everybody else gets to live in, unless you're Bill Gates. And what is clear now is that is a false dichotomy, because design actually has a really profound impact on mental health, decisions, behavior, quality of life, physical health, which means that everybody deserves to get good design.
With regard to high ceilings, you even suggest that people are more open to creative new concepts if they are in a room with higher ceilings when they hear about the concept. I mean, it sounds like a metaphor, but it's actually the case, right?
It is. I mean, what they did is they had people take tests of creativity in rooms with 8-foot ceilings or something like that, and then they brought people back and they put them in a room with very high ceilings, and they gave them different but similar tests, scoring similar things, tests on creativity, and they thought more creatively in the room with high ceilings. And that gets to an important point, which is which is the word you use, metaphor, which is that we use what are called schemas, which is basically patterns of association that we draw from living in our bodies in the world on Earth, experiencing gravity, having day follow night, and so on and so forth, that are drawn from our own experience of living as human beings on Earth. It's called embodied cognition. And many of those schemas are metaphorical. They're not literal. And so we have to expand out the kind of ways that we analyze what good design is and means beyond just the functional and the rational, because a lot of the things that have profound impact on us are things that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Like another study, a pretty famous one, they gave personnel, people in human resources departments, resumes, a stack of resumes to assess, and they handed them out on clipboards, whatever, and they said, assess these candidates. And it turned out that the people doing the assessing assessed candidates as having more intellectual gravitas and being better suited for the position when they were holding clipboards that were heavier.
When the candidates were, or when the assessors were?
When the assessors were holding clipboards on which they were looking at the resumes, the clipboards were heavier. Some clipboards were heavy and some were light.
It sounds again like a metaphor. They interpreted the application as being weightier, the resume as
correct.
Being weightier. Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah. And so we're constantly, when we're in our environments, I mean, that's an example of what psychologists call priming. We're being primed. It's almost like the whole subliminal seduction thing in the 1970s and 80s, you know, that they flash an image up and it would have an impact, you know, it would make you go and buy this liquor because you saw a naked woman there. Well, actually, some of that is really true. We're being primed by our built environments because that's where we live. Really, all the time. So the question is, what are we priming people to? How are we priming them to act and to communicate with one another, and so on and so forth? So there's the psychological component of this, and there's also the physiological component of this, which is what I started out talking about with, you know, healing from surgery and so on. And there's a lot of studies about that.
Yeah.
Regarding exposure to nature, exposure to natural light, exposure to different kinds of natural light, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you talk about light, color, form, sound, mm-hmm. and smell, and texture, temperatures, all these factors as actually impacting mental and physical and childhood development and intelligence,
yep.
and life expectancy. I mean, that's... Give us some more examples and what we might be doing differently with this knowledge.
Well, child development is is a good example because it's one that tugs at people's hearts a lot, and it's really important, right? I mean, everybody wants children to develop well. That's why we want better schools rather than worse schools for our children, and so on and so forth. So there was a study in the UK done, which was sort of a long-term study of some 2,000, I think, students in 57 different classrooms, but the curriculum that they were being taught and the basic level of teaching ability of the teachers was the same, and it was also controlled for socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
And but these 57 classrooms were scored on 6 or 8 or whatever dimensions of design, including color, fostering creativity, flexibility, natural light, and so on and so forth. They followed students for 2 years, and by the end of 2 years, they found that the students in the best designed classroom were nearly a full year ahead academically from the students in the worst designed classroom.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And how were the designs different?
They fostered creativity. They were flexible, so you could rearrange seating for various different kinds of educational activities. They had much more natural light. They had access to the outdoors. I don't remember what the other one, the color, the use of color. You know, color is very complicated, but color, and it is to some extent culturally determined, but there we know physiologically that humans respond to certain colors in certain ways, and that's cross-cultural. And this is that's just one little piece of knowledge. It's kind of obvious that we should be paying attention to this and really using it. And I think that the reason that people haven't in the past, I mean, some people intuit it, but again, you know, it's sort of a discretion or doing, using these kinds of things has always been seen as discretionary.
Yeah.
Well, you can do it, but, you know, only if you can pay for it and all this kind of stuff. It's not discretionary. It's critical. It's central.
Sarah Goldhagen, your book is called Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. You do take on this argument in the book, but what about the argument that boring boxes are just cheaper to make and that we're up against problems of concentration of wealth and population explosion that can't really be addressed by good design?
There's an easy answer to that, and it's sort of a quip, but and so I'll say it as a quip and then I'll explain it. But the quip is, it's just as expensive to design a bad building as a good building. And the explanation, which is actually much more precise, is that at any level of investment, you can get a better design or a worse design. But you have to help people to understand that design is important in the first place. And you have to give them all the information that is, in fact, out there and is growing every day about what kinds of aspects of design really have an effect on people, in order to help them figure out what they want to do. So right now, big boxes are cheaper, but, you know, you can do an awful lot with a big box design if you just hire someone who knows how to think these things through and who knows what the right priorities should be for the built environment. Because buildings, you know, here I'm talking about buildings, but also landscapes, once they're put in the ground, they're there for a really long time. They're not just there for the people who paid for them. They're not just there for the people who designed them. They're for everybody. People walk by them. They walk through them. They change ownership. They change functions.
Yeah.
And so this is really important. It's not just, you know, buying a nicer jacket versus buying a functional one.
It seems like it's just...
And they go on for generations.
A lot of things are designed, right? I mean, it seems like the average normal-priced automobile is beautifully sculpted with curves and angles. And so, I mean, if you could blow it up to the size of the building, I'd like to live in most cars, right?
But I love that.
But somehow the people who buy cars need that to be willing to buy the car. But the people who buy buildings don't. They're happy with ugly buildings.
They're happy with ugly buildings because buildings are, if you think about the way that most people think of buildings or, you know, any kind of landscapes, because I talk about urban design and landscapes and buildings, all of them.
Sure.
Most people think of the environment that they inhabit as kind of stage sets, sort of neutral spaces. And what's important is what's going on that stage, which is your life. You're changing your kid's diaper, you're arguing with your wife, whatever, you know, you're writing the next great American novel and so on. And that's what you're engaged in. People aren't really focused on their environments very much. And we have to shift that. Instead of, take the metaphor of the stage set, instead of the stage set, what our built environments are our habitats. And they, just as an animal's habitat will profoundly shape how that animal does, how it fares, how it evolves, and so on. These are our habitats.
Yeah. The other hurdle that you take on in the book, or one of them, is that you describe people having a preference for the familiar that can override a preference for what you say is demonstrably actually better and healthier and more enjoyable. How does so people can become accustomed to an ugly habitat and develop a preference for it?
Sure. I mean, let's kind of a straightforward example is let's say you grew up in Levittown. You know, where they're small, these are tiny houses, they're not very well designed, they're kind of, they're not very well put together, and they all look the same, right? But you grow up there. And so day after day, you had relations with your mother there, relations with your father, with your friends, you made friends, you went to school, and so on and so forth. You know, those memories become very deeply embedded and very, and are constitutive a part of who you are and who you identify yourself as being. And so when you think about what you want, people like things that are familiar. And this is one of the great contributions of the research that Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky did in behavioral economics. You know, they found that just the very fact that you own something or that it's familiar will skew you towards choosing it, even if that object, in the first case, is objectively worthless. Or objectively, in the second case, not nearly as good as the alternative.
And so how do you break that cycle?
You give them better things to grow up in.
So forget the old people and save the children.
Well, you know, it's an interesting problem that, yes, save the children is basically my that's part of my message. You know, as I was working on this book, I moved from a kind of very leafy, nice suburb outside of Boston, Newton, Massachusetts, to East Harlem, which has one of the highest concentrations of social housing anywhere in the country and is a very poor neighborhood. And, you know, I walk out of my front door every day and I see these deteriorating buildings, very poorly maintained, poorly built to begin with. And I think, you know, these people, these children, are not getting nearly as good a shot in life just by occupying these environments.
And,
the deck is so stacked.
And your book might have been even better if you hadn't been living in that location, maybe.
No, I think it was improved, actually, because honestly, it started out as being really an investigation into what we now know about human perception and cognition and how that changes how our understanding of people's environments. And the more research I did and the more I looked around, the more I saw the social component as absolutely central to the argument.
Yeah. So let me ask a question as a non-scientist, Luddite, who knows very little about neuroscience.
Why should you?
Well, it seems to be central to the case here, to understanding the evidence, right? That a lot of our experience of the environment is not conscious, but we can go and examine brains in laboratories and discover that these aspects of our environment are having impacts on us. And I wonder how much that unaware impact really exists. I mean, it seems you give examples like Yale's Art and Architecture building. People non-consciously don't like it because they imagine touching its rough surface would be, you know, it would hurt to brush up against it. But that seems like a thought that could become conscious, especially after you've pointed it out to people. And like something it would be very hard to discover in a brain in a laboratory. It seems more like something you're actually aware of. And you give all these examples of architects who you tend to use the word intuited. They intuited that this material would have this effect prior to the existence of neuroscience. You know, so is it really things that we're unaware of, or things that some people are somewhat unaware of? What are we dealing with here?
Okay, these are great questions. Let me go through them one by one. the reason in the book I use the word, and I explain this, I use the word non-conscious.
Yeah.
Is to differentiate it from unconscious. Unconscious means you can't get access to this. Like the fact that our heart is beating, is we're not conscious of that. I mean, we can sort of become conscious of it, but that's a bad example. But let's take different examples. Basically, what we know about human consciousness now makes it pretty clear that consciousness is a spectrum. And by consciousness, I mean aware that you're aware of something, right?
Yeah.
And the human mind, the way that the mind is constructed, you can only hold one concrete, coherent thought or percept, they call it, in your mind at one time. But there's all this other stuff going on that is underneath, if you want to say it that way, underneath that one thought, the thought being, I got to go change the laundry and put it in the dryer, okay, or something, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
with all the other stuff, or with a lot of that other stuff that you're not really consciously thinking about, you could think about it. So it's just a matter of where you direct your attention and to the kind, what value you place on these things that are, you know, we're always under cognitive assault. There's so much sensory stimulation every minute we live.
Yeah.
And so it's not that that we cannot be conscious of these things. It's that most people aren't most of the time. And so if they focus on it, and they, you know, you might think, ugh, I don't like the AMA building at Yale by Paul Rudolph because it has this concrete aggregate that's very stony, and if you rub up against it, it's going to hurt you. You could think all of that, or you could just say, blech, what an ugly building.
Yeah.
And move on, because that's what most people would do. They're not thinking about the building. They're thinking about their life. So that's part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, that is why the use of cognitive neuroscience. Two things. One, I used a lot of cognitive neuroscience and I used a lot of environmental psychology. So it was two different fields that I was really, I looked at other fields as well, but those were two of the principal ones. And it's not really very relevant that they've located the place in the brain where the neurons in the brain that we use for spatial navigation, which are called grid cells. I agree with you about that.
Yeah.
That's not that important. What is important about this information, particularly from cognitive neuroscience, is that it used to be that, okay, you mentioned two architects whose works I discuss. One is Alvar Aalto. The other is Frank Lloyd Wright, I think. And I say that they intuited things. So, up until now, throughout all of history, there were people who, of course, intuited that, you know, if you look at a surface texture, it actually makes you sort of feel like you want to touch it or not touch it, okay?
Yeah.
But that was one theory and one approach of doing design in the built environment among a whole slew of other theories and approaches. So I happen to mention in my book the people who were intuiting these things. Richard Neutra is another one, okay? There were a lot of people who weren't doing it, and that's because they were under different ideas. They were interested in mass production. They thought that, there was a theory, for example, in Germany in the 1920s that buildings should look as identical to one another as possible because modern man moved a lot, and therefore he would want to go to places that looked exactly the same in Munich as the one he's moving to in Heidelberg.
Yes.
And, what my book shows is that there's a certain line of architectural thinking and design thinking, and that wins out, and we have the evidence for it.
And should part of getting to a world of better design and where everything mm-hmm. is well designed be making ourselves more aware and making others more aware of the world around them and becoming much more conscious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, here's an analogy. You know, I don't know how old you are. I'm 58 years old. So when I was growing up, we didn't really think about what we ate. We just ate, right? You know, it was like food. You felt hungry. Then you ate something. You got away. So then there was this whole revolution in food, and suddenly we think we have to eat healthy, lots of vegetables. Food has become much more important in terms of what we eat, how we eat it, when we eat it, and so on and so forth, than it was when, certainly when I and my husband were growing up as kids.
Yeah.
I'm calling for the same kind of revolution here about the built environment.
Yeah, it's a powerful case that you make in the book. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I wonder, my favorite thing with books that I like is to find the things I want to argue with. So you predict that by 2050 we're going to have another almost 2.5 billion people needing new spaces built for them to live and work in. I can't imagine any design so good that's going to be, you know, survivable, that our ecosystem, that our climate. I mean, how can we plan for such a world? How can this planet even possibly support such a world?
Look, I'm all with you. That's too many people. It's going to be crushing and so on and so forth. But it's a little like saying, you know, climate change is so important. Why aren't you thinking about climate change? Well, a lot of things are important.
Yes.
But the built environment is also important. And I show why. That's the first answer to your question. The second is that there are a number of people who are breaking down the dimensions of design in such a way you can make these. I mean, they're going to be built anyway. That was my point in the book. This building is going to happen. You can do it better or you can do it worse.
Right.
And here are the consequences of doing it worse, and here are the consequences of doing it better. What do you want to do? And even in very large-scale buildings, there are people who are beginning to study and look at how you can make these, you know, these residential buildings in these unimaginably large megalopolises in Asia, for example, offer the kind of humanistic dimensions that people need when they live in habitats.
I think I'm afraid we are out of time.
Okay,
I wish
good.
We could go on for hours, but the book is a wonderful place to start if we're going to have movement to have a better designed world. Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives by Sarah Williams Goldhagen. Sarah, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
David, it was my pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, West Virginia teachers and school staffers, among the lowest paid in the country, won a 5% pay raise for all of the state's public sector workers after a 9-day walkout over pay and surging health care costs. Much coverage of what there was sympathetic, though some reports stuck to corporate media's old recipe, like the AP piece that said the deal, quote, ended a paralyzing strike that shut students out of classrooms statewide, forced parents to scramble for childcare, and cast a national spotlight on government dysfunction in West Virginia, close quote. Media will need to shake up their reporting on how workers fight, because it looks like West Virginia won't be the end of this sort of action. Counterspin spoke with veteran labor reporter Mike Elk about the historic West Virginia walkout. He's senior labor reporter and founder of Payday Report, the South's first unionized digital co-op. He also writes for The Guardian. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. In its March 5th front pager, A Russian Threat on Two Fronts Meets an American Strategic Void, the New York Times passes along the worries of Washington. As expressed by a few military higher-ups, a guy from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a disembodied United States, worries that Trump doesn't have a coherent strategy for dealing with cyber and nuclear threats from Russia. The subhead warned, quote, Russia has ramped up its arsenal. U.S. has done little in response, close quote. So, Adam Johnson asks in a piece for FAIR.org, what does a little response look like? Since taking office, the Trump administration and Congress, citing the Russian challenge as one of their rationales, have increased the military budget by about $80 billion, the largest increase since the aftermath of 9/11, and 70% greater than the entire Russian military budget of $47 billion. Additionally, Trump has reportedly asked for a black budget of over $80 billion for covert operations and pledged more than $1.2 trillion to building up the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal over the next 30 years, $200 billion more than Obama asked Congress for when he announced the plan 2 years ago. And Trump has, again, asked to increase the military budget by even more to $716 billion for 2019. The piece's focus is on what it says some experts believe is a lack of strategy, but still leaving out the unprecedented amounts of money and resources Trump has spent on the military under the guise of combating Russia is a massive omission. In the nuclear sphere, the Times says, the Trump administration has yet to offer a strategy to contain or deter Russia beyond simply matching the weapons buildup. Here as elsewhere, the U.S. only responds to threats, never issues them, only matches Russia's weapons buildup, doesn't incite it. The fact that the U.S.'s most recent nuclear revamp began in earnest in 2014, before Donald Trump even announced his campaign, is not mentioned. At one point, the Times reporters offer the general perception of the entire government, declaring, quote, the United States is still uncertain how to make use of its cyber weapons after spending billions of dollars to build an arsenal. It is concerned that the Russians, along with the Chinese, the Iranians, and the North Koreans, could easily retaliate against any attack, striking American banks, utilities, stock markets, and communications networks. Close quote. It might help to know who exactly feels this way, but the story doesn't narrow it down. The effect of the article by intent or accident is to justify even more military spending, as Trump and Congress plan yet another massive increase for 2019. And here we get it, around paragraph 16. Quote, "We must no longer think in terms of building just limited missile defense capabilities," concluded a report that was issued last year by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. "The United States should begin the journey to develop a next-generation missile defense." It called for pursuing a space-based kill layer that would try to shoot down swarms of enemy warheads and missiles, a step that would go beyond the Reagan administration's Star Wars research on space arms and no doubt prompt new rounds of reaction from Mr. Putin and the Russian military. Close quote. So here the Times quotes CSIS doing what CSIS was set up and specifically funded to do. Push for the U.S. to buy ever more elaborate and exotic weapons systems. The story sets up an itch, and CSIS comes along to scratch it. There's a void in response to the Russian threat, and oh, here's this strategy by a very official group with strategic right in its name, and it's calling for an obscene amount of spending on new missile systems that blow things up from space. Whoever could possibly build such a system? By sheer coincidence, five of CSIS's top 10 corporate funders, including Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, are positioned to do just that. As the New York Times itself reported in August 2016, after it obtained a cache of private emails from the organization, CSIS is little more than a lobbying arm of the weapons industry. Fair noted last summer, talking about the think tank's promotion of the Lockheed-built THAAD missile system in South Korea, that 30 out of 30 times when CSIS weighs in on the wisdom of a weapon system, it's in support. Fair asked the center if they'd ever publicly opposed a new weapons purchase or deployment, but they didn't get back to us. 2 years ago, the New York Times insisted that the U.S. was lagging behind Russia in the Arctic, citing another CSIS report. How did that turn out? Well, in May of last year, the torrent of media articles hyping the Arctic gap paid dividends, with Congress allocating an additional $1 billion to the Navy's budget to pay for icebreaker ships. Those contracts aren't awarded yet, but market analysts like the Motley Fool tell us top CSIS donor Lockheed Martin is the obvious choice to build the new fleet. Now, CSIS releases a report saying the Russians are getting the better of us in cyber and nuclear. Outlets like the Times spread that message. Their reporting is then used as further evidence that we need more military spending, and that spending is lavished on CSIS's clients. Meanwhile, the group continues to be treated as a neutral, objective Washington think tank, and it's well documented, including by the Times itself, conflicts of interest go unmentioned. Syria, too, is an area where corporate media depict the U.S. as passive when it's anything but. The U.S. and Western partners are hovering passively on the sidelines in Syria, said The Guardian's Simon Tisdall, echoed by ABC's Connor Finnegan, who's concerned that the U.S. will remain on the sidelines in the country. Newsweek says that both the Obama and Trump administrations have offered words of outrage from the UN ambassador, accompanied by nothing else. In reality, as Gregory Shupak reports for Fair.org, the U.S. currently controls 28% of Syria and has recently declared its intent to continue occupying the country indefinitely. Joshua Landis of the Center for Middle East Studies notes the U.S. controls half of Syria's energy resources, the Euphrates Dam at Tabqa, as well as much of Syria's best agricultural land. A covert CIA operation aimed at ousting the Syrian government, with a budget of $1 billion per year, was used to arm anti-government militias and run secret training camps in Jordan, The Washington Post reported in 2015. And the U.S. has provided financial support for the Syrian opposition since at least 2012, coordinating weapons shipments to them no later than May of that year. Yet for Western corporate media, this constitutes sitting on the sidelines. The effect of such coverage, Shupak notes, besides grossly misleading readers about their government's role, is to encourage audiences to accept greater Western military intervention in the country without examining the likely consequences. A comparable undertaking in Libya, far from ending that country's war, left it riven by factional fighting that has no end in sight and brought slave markets to the country. Regime change in Iraq resulted in approximately 500,000 deaths there. Advocating that such steps be taken in Syria without respectful attention to what recent history shows the potential outcomes would be constitutes severe media malpractice. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by FAIR, the Media Watch Group. A deal was signed giving all public employees in West Virginia a 5% pay raise after a 9-day work stoppage by teachers and school staffers that shut down every school in the state. More than 20,000 teachers and 13,000 staffers walked out February 22nd, mainly over health care costs, despite the fact that they had no legal right to strike. And a funny thing happened. The public supported them, and they won. The teachers and staffers, we understand, are feeling joy and relief. Observers around the country seem to be feeling something else, inspired. Mike Elk is senior labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. He writes also for The Guardian. He joins us now by phone from Pittsburgh. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mike Elk.
So great to be on the show with you, Janine. I'm such a big fan of your work.
Thank you. Well, this deal in West Virginia is not perfect, particularly in terms of how things will be funded, and we'll talk about that. But first, it's important to claim victories, even as we push for more. Could you just talk a bit about why the West Virginia teachers' action is meaningful, is significant right now?
Well, I think it shows a couple things. Right now, the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up a case called Janus, and what that would do is drastically reduce the ability of unions to collect dues off of all their members. It would allow people in, you know, certain workplaces in the public sector to opt out of paying dues. It could hurt unions. So there's been all this alarmist rhetoric that, oh, unions are going to go under, blah, blah, blah. When in the South, you've had unions that don't have collective bargaining rights, that don't even have dues checkoff at all, that are in right-to-work states, that have been winning victories for decades. And I think what West Virginia showed was that, hey, the law can be against you and you can still win. So it was a real shot of energy to the labor movement in that way. I also think it was really an expression of Me Too in the workplace. I don't think this has been covered as much, but nationally, about 79% of teachers are women. One of the big issues that really upset a lot of women in this struggle for contract was that in order to get $500 a year off of your health insurance costs, you had to participate in a wellness program where you had to wear a Fitbit that monitored your every move. And a lot of women really objected to this, you know, that this was invasive, that this was invading women's bodies, that this was the male state legislature refusing to give a pay raise and wanting to do this terribly invasive thing. And so I think this is also a big victory for the Me Too movement in the workplace and could inspire other types of public sector strikes. Already, Pittsburgh teachers were in union talks while the West Virginia strike is going on, and Pittsburgh's about 45 minutes from West Virginia. We share a lot of the same media market. And so last Monday, they voted to strike. And what winded up happening was they voted to strike on Monday and gave notice they would go out on Friday. By that Wednesday, the school district folded and gave them everything they wanted. So it was already showing an effect here in Pittsburgh, and now today in Oklahoma, the teachers union announced there that they were going to go out on strike on April 2nd. So how far this thing goes is really unclear, but it's been a long time since the labor movement had a victory this big, on this big of a scale, a mass walkout over an entire state. And, you know, even though they didn't get everything they wanted with the health insurance plan, they put themselves in a position where they gained leverage and support. So they were able to get a 5% pay raise, just not for teachers, but for all public employees, which helped them out in terms of gaining more public support, because initially that wasn't on the table at all. The
right.
Other public employees were going to get 2% less.
Right.
They got a 19-month freeze to all out-of-pocket health care costs, which is a big victory. And then they got set up a task force to study how to fix the state health insurance program. It's supposed to have a report presented by October, and this task force will have many members of the teachers union on it. And it's important that that's coming in October, because in October, the state legislature comes back into session, and then in November, there are legislative elections. So if no action is taken, it really puts the issue front and center and puts the union in a position to fight another day, rather than going on a multi-week strike where they might lose support. You know, a strike is a very difficult thing to maintain. And these teachers did a great job of doing community outreach, of setting up daycares, of setting up lunch programs, making sure that children were provided for during the strike and keeping public support on their side. So it's really a remarkable victory for the labor movement.
Well, I was going to ask about that public support, which I wasn't actually sure how deep it went, how strong it was. I heard it referenced, but do people seem to be seeing the big picture? In other words, there didn't seem to be this splitting of teachers' interests versus parents' interests or versus students' interests. There was, and part of this was the union workers' positive effort to hold on to that public support. But do you think there's a shift in the wind in some degree, or is it special to that area that there would be such kind of support for a strike like this?
I think a combination of things. I think there's somewhat of a shift in the wind. But at the same time, I mean, it is West Virginia. It's a state with a very deep radical labor history. You know, these teachers were talking about how they had seen their teachers walk out in 1990, about how their grandparents had walked out of the coal mines in 1969 when 40,000 coal miners went on strike demanding black lung benefits. So there's a history of mass walkouts in the political consciousness of West Virginia,
right,
going all the way back to the 20s. Further than that, you know, going back to the mine wars. And so there's always been this history of it. So it's unique. And I think why the public supported them so much in West Virginia is because the situation is so bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's something like 700 vacancies in West Virginia schools. It's not uncommon for kids to have three or four teachers for one subject in one year, or to have classes that simply turn into substitute periods. I was looking at a map of West Virginia, and it was showing that over 60% of students in the southern counties of West Virginia, over 60% of those students, when they go away to college, have to take remedial courses. So people know on a very deep level that the education system is broken in West Virginia. And there's a very deep cultural sense of, you know, our history is engaging in these kind of radical struggles. So, you know, the public support from what I saw out on picket lines in terms of people stopping and honking the horns was very, very high. And there wasn't ever a real campaign of angry school parents against them. Actually, the PTA endorsed the effort. So there wasn't significant opposition. And as you can see, you know, the Republican governor and the Republican state legislators were forced to fold on their positions very quickly because they had no political space to stand on.
Well, let me ask you about one of the, you know, kind of asterisks, which is that there was some hope, wasn't there, that the pay increases and the improvements on the insurance plan, which was teachers' big concern, that those might be funded with a tax on natural gas?
Yes.
So what happened with that?
That got nowhere. Instead, there was this provision that there was something like $58 million in projected revenue when they changed their revisions. So instead of doing that, they cut the budget in other areas, mainly because the natural gas industry doesn't want to see fracking taxed.
Well, and I noticed in something that I think that you had written, the note that the coal folks, including the governor, their negligence in tax paying has something to do with the cutbacks in the first place.
Well, yeah, Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia, owes something like $15 million in taxes in six different states. These are big, big landholders, these coal and gas companies. And, you know, they often don't pay their taxes for legal reasons and nobody cracks down on them. And so there's a huge issue of not getting enough revenue in a place like West Virginia.
Well, let's talk about media. Traditionally, corporate media's antipathy to labor actions is almost comic. They pit workers against consumers. They stress the hardship or the traffic tie-ups or whatever that are caused by strikes. And then you add to that the lack of love for the public sector. You know, teachers are dumbing down our kids, and you know, don't get them started on the Postal Service. You know, I guess I just expected worse coverage. But is it that there was relatively little national coverage till late in the day? What did you make of media's treatment of the West Virginia teachers' action?
A lot of different things. I think it showed the need for professional labor press corps, just not in the corporate media, but also in the left press. There was very little reporting from a national perspective where national publications were actually sending reporters to West Virginia. I think Dave Jamieson from the Huffington Post went, I went. I think someone from The Intercept went, but not that many national publications did. However, CNN really caught up to the ball game. And I think the coverage was much more, you know, there were flaws in it in terms of details and things like that.
Right.
But the coverage was much more sympathetic.
Yeah.
And I think that's really has to relate back to the huge wave of pro-union sentiment you've seen now in the media industry over the last 3.5 years.
Yeah.
I was trying to organize a union back at Politico in 2015, and the Washington Post at the time wrote this article called Why Don't Internet Journalists Organize? And it basically argued, the Washington Post, that organizing will never happen in the media industry. But then 5 months later, Gawker happened. You know, I wasn't really involved in that. But after Gawker, there was a lot of conversations that had already been taking place prior to Gawker, but that were amplified and given support. And what we found when we organized in the media industry is that when people get coverage, they do organize because they get support. They know they have public support. And so over the last 3 years, we've seen something like 36 media outlets or some number. It was above 30 organized. I lost count.
Right.
And we've seen major ones like the LA Times organize, as well as Mike and Vice and Fox and HuffPost. We've seen a lot of big outlets organize. And so there's a big pro-union sentiment in the industry right now. And I think that's starting to play out in some of this reporting that's happening. I think a lot of the media realize also that they missed the boat on Bernie in 2016. They don't want to miss the boat again. So I don't think we saw that same kind of media coverage. On the other end, there's a trend in the left press that I like to call yuppie-splaining. There's this term out there, mansplaining, about, you know, when men explain obvious things to women. And there's this term, white-splaining, you know, when white people explain what it's like to be a person of color to people of color. But my friend Jamie was joking that there ought to be yuppie-splaining. You know, I come from a very blue-collar background in coal country, a union household. And, you know, there's this trend now in the left press, I think, to write these really elitist narratives of labor struggles. And so we started seeing all these labor stories in the left press that, like, wouldn't even quote workers, that were drawing all these big picture analysis of what was happening and then lecturing people on, well, you have to understand the whole history of West Virginia. And it just wasn't really rooted at all in the story of what people were doing. So, you know, I think we both in the corporate media and in the left press have a long way to go to really developing a better professional labor press corps, because it is a specialized area. It does require a lot of knowledge, and it does really require you to go out of your way and actually quote workers, you know, just not write hot takes, but actually get out into the field, have lunch with people, spend a lot of time with people, and get a sense of what the feeling is like among organizing, because you can't understand organizing over the phone. You can only really understand it when you're out there with workers.
Well, your latest pieces have been talking about a possible catch-on effect or the inspiration that the West Virginia strike is having. And we talked about in Oklahoma, for example. I've also heard, well, in today's headlines, Arizona teachers, maybe Kentucky teachers. And I think it's not just kind of, oh, there's an example, they did it, we can do it. It's also maybe even a more literal, there are people out there who will have our backs if we do this. You know, sort of touching on what you were just saying, I don't know if people can really imagine how, if they haven't done it, how frightening it is to go on strike, you know, even if it's very official and sanctioned. You know, it's not as if, well, you just eat peanut butter for a week and then you win. There's a lot of untold story and just how difficult it is and how up against it people are. And that's why solidarity is really like a material resource to people involved in these things.
Oh, yeah. And We were out on the picket line in Wheeling, West Virginia, on the first day, and the teachers out there were very nervous to come out. You know, they weren't really certain what kind of support they would get, if they would, people would be flipping them off. You know, they knew they had a lot of support, but people always think they have a lot of support because we live in silos. And on that first day, there was just so much support. And then it kept building and building. But if that strike had gone on for another week or two, would there have been that same level of enthusiasm? It's very tough to maintain strikes or lockouts for a long period of time. You know, people get bored. You know, you can only stand so much on the picket line and chant. These things are very tough to do and tough to maintain. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in Oklahoma, because, you know, we're entering a new space of organizing, which I think we're only beginning to understand. And I know that might sound cliche, but social media has really shaken things up in terms of the positive feedback loop it provides people, particularly in West Virginia. You know, they would go on Facebook, they would look at what all their friends and neighbors were posting, and they knew people had their back. You know, 10 years ago, you didn't have that. You know, however the corporate media covered you was how you pretty much thought what the world was like outside of the people you talked to on a daily basis. So that's really changing the dynamic. And I think this coming at the same time that students are walking out, and there's a general sense among a lot of people fed up with the Trump era of just wanting to shut it down.
We've been speaking with Mike Elk, senior labor reporter at Payday Report. They're online at paydayreport.com. His article, West Virginia Teachers Triumph Offers Fresh Hope for U.S. Workers' Rights, appeared in The Guardian. Mike Elk, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the Media Watch group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly newsletter called Extra. You can find subscription information on our website, fair.org. And if you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those shows and their transcripts on the website as well. And you can show support for the show if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Did a comet strike the Earth 12,800 years ago, causing global wildfires and starting an age of cooling? Scientists are still arguing whether that happened. In the show, we start with Dr. Joanne Ballard, a co-author of two new papers with evidence that it did happen. I'll follow with comet expert Mark Boslow. He says the science behind this hypothesis is flawed. Then I'll close with my own impressions of the science, the believers, and why all this matters a lot for our future. After all, the next comet strike can come at any time. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's go. In the second week of February 2018, two unexpected comets passed by the Earth, and they came closer than the moon. The mystery is, why have we not been hit by a large rock from space during the human times, at least as much as we can remember? A group of scientists say there was a strike around 12,000 years ago. They claim it darkened Earth with fires on multiple continents, wiping out large animals, and kicking off a cooling period known as the Younger Dryas. Around 2006, a couple of books were published on this comet strike, with lots of media coverage. There was also pushback from other scientists, claiming it never happened or there wasn't enough evidence. Two new papers have been published in the Journal of Geology. The lead author in both is Wendy S. Wolbach, along with 26 other scientists. To make the case for a climate-changing, extinction-level comet strike just a few thousand years before the discovery of agriculture and the rise of civilization, here is co-author Joanne P. Ballard. Dr. Ballard is an archaeologist for the Tennessee Valley Authority in Knoxville. Joanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, too. You know, there's so much to this story, but why don't we start with this? Talk to us about the trail of extraordinary fires found by your group happening around 12,800 years ago. How big were they, and how do we know that they happened?
Okay, well, this paper initially was a response to the 2009 Jennifer Marlin paper that came out where she synthesized 35 charcoal records across North America. But she did not have very many records across the Midwest, and their results were, we don't really see a peak for the onset of the Younger Dryas. So since then, I have developed several charcoal records, actually from Four Lakes in Michigan, and so that's been added. And Jacqueline Gill and Katie Leininger also contributed charcoal data sets from Indiana and Ohio. And so those have helped fill in a gap where we didn't have any data. And so in this paper by Wallback and others, there's 152 charcoal records. So we've got a larger data set. And this time, when we run the statistics on it, it does show a peak at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
And some of those fires, though, were they in Africa or Europe or other places besides North America?
I think that we used in this paper data sets from North America.
Okay.
I think the focus is on North America. And then to support that, because that's just, you know, one aspect. You're just looking at charcoal, and it's an imperfect proxy. So we need other lines of evidence, and one of these would be the Greenland ice cores, the gold standard for paleo environments. So we look at chemical markers in those to support combustion. And there's certain chemicals in there such as formate, oxalate, ammonium that give an indication of broad scale combustion, biomass burning. And so we do see peaks in those chemicals for the onset of the Younger Dryas. That helps support the idea that, you know, there was a widespread wildfire event at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
Just to get an idea of your work, you personally presented a conference paper in 2014 on the late glacial fires in Alabama and Michigan. What did you find?
So that was presented at the Southeastern Archaeological Conference in Greenville, South Carolina. And the sites were Cahaba Pond, Alabama, which had been worked on before by Hazel Delcourt. She, in fact, collected the cores and did pollen analysis on the cores. And so that gives us insight into the vegetation that was growing in the lake basin. And so if you core different lakes over a larger region, you get a pretty good picture of what was growing there 14,000 years ago, 13,000 years ago, and so on into the Holocene. So the Cahaba Pond record started at 14,000 years ago, and beech was the dominant species, along with a lesser species that was there at the pond was hop hornbeam. And both of those species are fire intolerant. So we would not expect to see lots of fires if these trees are thriving. So they're coming along doing well. And then in the younger dryas, there's a drastic change. The beech and hop hornbeam go away, and oak and southern pines become the dominant species there. And you can see in the core itself, there's some kind of dramatic change from mineral-rich to organic-rich sediment in the pond. So this was a very intriguing core to work on. So then I wanted to do the charcoal analysis, and is there any other proxy I can use to look for something unusual across the Younger Dryas boundary, across the Lake Glacial. So together with Stephen Dreese, who is a soil scientist at Baylor, he was on my committee at the University of Tennessee, we used thin sections. So these are paper-thin slices of epoxied mud, and this technique is usually applied to soils, but we decided we wanted to try it on lake sediments. What microstructures can we see? And we got a very intriguing result, and that is, there were these structures in there that are siliceous aggregates. And the initial question was, well, where did they come from and what does this mean? So it turns out that they form from wood ash. So wood ash is another byproduct of fire. And the wood ash, there's little silica structures in the twigs, bark, and leaves of trees. And when they burn, those phytoliths are in the ash. And in that highly alkaline environment, as you get water percolating through the ash, that silica turns to a gel. And if there is silt, which would be dust, another word for silt is dust, the silica gel sticks to the silt substrate and hardens up. And this is remaining evidence of a wildfire. So the interesting thing about finding those siliceous aggregates at Cahaba Pond is, you know, there are actually six sites that we looked at. Five of them had siliceous aggregates during the Lake Glacial. So we also looked in Anderson Pond at other periods of time in the core, because we don't want to like say that they're specific to the Lake Glacial if it's a common thing. But actually, we did not find any in Holocene sediments. So this, to me, looks like another potential marker for some event. But we need to do more work on this because it is a promising new proxy for wildfire that would supplement charcoal data, soot, and soot data, and so on.
Boy, we're looking for the footprints of fire more than 12,000 years ago and finding them. That's kind of exciting stuff. I have to say, one of my listeners, who is a geologist who also tracks hits from outer space, he suggests these fires could have natural causes. And he's talking about a peak temperature that generally ends the warmer states known as stadials just before cooling time, like the Younger Dryas. Could the fires that you've discovered and discussed in your paper have been simply due to climate change rather than a comet strike?
Okay, Alex, this is an excellent question and one that I've asked myself. So how do we differentiate? Because we have forest fires today. Some of them are fairly large. You know, it's a common thing in the boreal forests of Canada to have forest fires. So how do we differentiate that we've got a catastrophic wildfire situation? So this is where a multi-proxy approach has to be used. So you look for something else that distinguishes those fires from other wildfires. So in the biomass burning paper, in addition to the charcoal, we looked at soot. We supplemented with the platinum peak although that's more of an extraterrestrial signature, but also the chemical markers for biomass burning in the ice cores. And those are ammonium formate, oxalate, and levoglucosan would be a good marker to analyze for, but that has not, that's only been done for the historical part of the Greenland ice cores.
On Radio EcoShock, scientists like Alan Robach explained nuclear winter that would follow a nuclear exchange, and other scientists have told us about a darkening that lasted for several years after an asteroid strike hit around the Gulf of Mexico 66 million years ago. What evidence does your group present to suggest there was an impact winter around 12,800 years ago?
Well, I talked to Wendy Walbeck about this because she's the soot expert, and she said we estimate YDB being the Younger Dryas boundary, the 12,800 years ago. We estimate a YDB soot footprint of 15 milligrams per square centimeter. When this amount of soot is injected into the atmosphere, the amount of time it stays aloft depends on how high it goes, a minimum of 7 days, more if it makes it into the stratosphere. So the soot's going to stay there longer if it's injected up into the stratosphere. She estimated that depending on how high up the soot went, and that it doesn't take a whole lot of soot to block out quite a bit of sunlight, she estimated darkness for months to a year. And she's comparing to the Cretaceous Paleogene event. That's where they estimated months to a year. And so I would say not over a year for the Younger Dryas event.
So the key to the whole Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, as it's known, is a hit by an object from outer space. What does your group think happened?
I consulted with Bill Napier on this, the astronomer in our group. And he says that we consider a swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide are much more likely to have occurred than maybe a large asteroid or something like that, and can account very well for the wildfires in Walbach et al. 2018. Such impacts would not usually leave craters, although we could certainly not rule out one or two larger objects as part of the mix.
So this was something that broke up in the air and then hit in multiple places at more or less the same time.
It could have, because there are also fires in Europe, and I have studied, they're called the Ousel Horizon, and it's a burn-rich layer that dates to approximately the beginning of the Younger Dryas that is in the cover sands there. And so I've studied four different sites over there. And those include, they're charcoal-rich, there's algae, there's sponge spicules, there's fused quartz, and there's melt glass in those layers. So that's suggesting a thermal pulse. So, but going back to what was the nature of this, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. If the impactor or impactors struck the Laurentide ice sheet, which was 2 miles thick and covered most of Canada, most of eastern Canada, you wouldn't have a crater. There'd be a lot of meltwater, and we do, in fact, see meltwater pulse 1A at the beginning of the Younger Dryas. So that is consistent with something sudden. And the Younger Dryas is pretty well agreed that the onset was very sudden from the ice cores and from other proxies. It was a fairly sudden thing.
There was a book in 2006 that I found. It's titled The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. Among the co-authors are two contributing authors to the new papers we're talking about in the Journal of Geology. That was Richard Firestone and Alan West. Are these two papers intended as further proof of the theory proposed in that book?
Bill Napier responded to this question because he was more familiar with that book. He said the original scenario in that book was a supernova exploded in our neighborhood 41,000 years ago and gave rise to a series of destructive shock waves as well as disturbing comets, and they were thrown in our direction. So he says this is untenable astronomically, but the ideas of the group have evolved, not randomly, but towards a pre-existing hypothesis, namely that we ran through the debris tail of a giant short-period disintegrating comet whose orbit sometimes intersects the Earth.
How would this arrival or impact drive large animals in North America into extinction?
Well, those that survived the initial blast and the wildfires and the shock waves would then be subjected to nitric acid rain, which is associated with, when you have a shockwave associated with an impact, it dissociates the nitrogen in the atmosphere and the ozone layer, breaks up the ozone layer, you get nitrates, and they'll rain out of the atmosphere for months to maybe a year. So that would suppress regrowth or reestablishment of the vegetation in the area. So their habitat would be destroyed. So if they survive the first impact, then they have to deal with destruction of their habitat. So that's going to be pretty challenging. And so with that acid rain has been well studied for its effects, like in Appalachia and Scandinavia, since the industrial age began. It's been a problem. So we know a lot about that. And it damages the leaves on trees. It kills off aquatic organisms, fish, salamanders, and so on. So it would also suppress, like, sprouting of seeds and would probably kill off the seeds. And then it's going to take a very long time for animals and other vectors of dispersal to bring in seeds to repopulate the area with plants and trees. And the other aspect of the acid rain associated with an impact would be that it's a nutrient input. So it's nitrogen, and although it has a destructive pH, it's also a nutrient, and so you get massive algal blooms. And so for pollen diagrams and diatom diagrams at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, that's what we see. We see a lot of diatom blooms, algal blooms. And in fact, one of the characteristic features that we see in sediments for the beginning of the Younger Dryas is these so-called black mats that have been studied by Vance Haynes and others, Jay Quaid. So these are algal-rich layers that have like these carbon spherules and magnetite grains. So why do we suddenly have all these algal overgrowth at that time? So that would be my hypothesis for that. And we should be studying a lot more nitrogen records, nitrogen isotopes, try and see if there's a common link there.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Has Earth really escaped a large strike from outer space during our human time? From Tennessee, we are talking with Dr. Joanne Ballard about two new papers that say a big hit changed the Earth relatively recently. Joanne, the NASA Center for Near-Earth Object Studies says no large impacts have occurred in the last 15,000 years. Your group disputes that?
Yes, and Bill Napier has answered this question. He said you might be thinking that the YDB was triggered by an object from outer space, but instead, instead of the initial Firestone idea of a 4-kilometer-wide comet, he considers large impacts are a red herring and proposes, as we said before, the swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide. And in my view, we might not be able to recognize all the impacts on Earth because a lot of them are unrecognized. We're a watery planet, and some of those impacts, if they go into the ocean, if they're not as large, I guess, we won't see them. If there's impacts in a forest region, the vegetation will close up and cover it up, and in desert situations. So I think the number is probably higher than recognized.
Let's get to the evidence, Joanne. The two papers look into the records provided by ice cores and glaciers, which you mentioned, and lake and marine and terrestrial sediments, which is more your specialty. There's a wide range of very technical isotopes and rare elements being talked about in these papers and in this subject generally. I find it's a little too detailed for me to grasp. What would you present as the top one or two proofs that this kind of event happened?
Well, I would say the iridium and platinum that we found, a platinum spike in the ice core. So I'd say that's pretty significant. And also, if we can find platinum in our sedimentary record as well, that would, I think, be a very, very strong supporting evidence.
Now, as you know, some scientists have been critical of the evidence. For example, Professor Nicholas Pinter, who's with the University of California, Davis now, he wrote a requiem for this hypothesis. Others say they've performed blind tests and failed to duplicate the evidence presented. How would you answer those critics, Joanne?
Well, I'd say for the Pinter requiem paper, one thing they challenged was the carbon spherules. And they proposed that these things found in the YDB layer were could easily be termite poop or fungal spores. I find that kind of ridiculous because the carbon spherules, to me, are just a combustion indicator. And so they form from combustion of forests, particularly coniferous forests. They just seem very biased in their approach. So, and then there's also the Surville paper, where they tried to replicate and they could not find the same indicators, but they didn't use the recommended methodology. They did not separate their fractions. That means take the sediment and sieve it and sort it into fractions and then look. So I think that might explain why they had difficulty replicating the results.
What holds your group of 29 authors together? Is there an inspirational person who first expressed this theory, or who would you say are leaders in the field now?
Well, I would say the group has the common interest of wanting to contribute more to this fascinating debate. You know, the charismatic woolly mammoths, what happened to them, and all the other 34 large mammals that used to be here and are now gone. We're a very collaborative group, and I'm glad to be part of it. I would say that the inspirational person for me is probably Rick Firestone. So I learned about this hypothesis from him when I attended a paleontology conference at the Mammoth Site in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And it really was very interesting that here's this, you know, up till then, the hypotheses for why did the mammoths go extinct were overhunting by people, climate change, and hyper disease. So now here we have this new fourth hypothesis. It's very intriguing. And so after that conference, I went on to be a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. Tom Lowell was my advisor there, and studied lake sediments for charcoal, looking for this big peak at the Younger Dryas. That was what I predicted. Oh, I'll find a big peak. Well, science and nature are not that cut and dried and simple. So yes, there were peaks. In one of them, there was a definite peak at the Younger Dryas in the four lakes that we sampled. But in the others, there were peaks, but there were also additional peaks. So this is where I know that you need to have additional lines of evidence. You can't just single out one and say, oh, this peak must be the one. So you have your supporting evidence that helps you figure out what's what. But Rick Firestone has taken a lot of criticism for introducing a new idea to science, but I'm really glad he had the gumption to do it.
This seems to be a big topic for Russian researchers as well, and I suppose that's natural considering the big hit in Siberia in 1908 and the recent surprise strike in Chelyabinsk, Russia, in February 2013. The Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences hold two databases of reported hits, and they evaluate them. Has anybody in your group talked with the Russian counterparts?
Okay, I heard from Bill Napier on this one, Alex, because he's the astronomer, and so this is more along his line of study. And he said the British cometary astronomers do indeed liaise with Russian colleagues from time to time. And Bill attended a conference in Moscow in 2008 for the 100th anniversary of the Tunguska impact. However, our interest is mainly in assessing the celestial hazard from a theoretical point of view, involving cometary dynamics rather than specific impacts such as Chelyabinsk. Our connections are international, say with American or Japanese colleagues, as much as with Russians. And I would say from a paleontology point of view, I keep up with the work of Sergei Leshinsky and other Russian researchers on the mammoth side of it. There's a lot of different aspects to this hypothesis.
There is, and it's really interesting to me, Joanne, because what you're talking about is also something that could happen at any time. We just had something appear out of the sky that they only saw 5 days ahead of it arriving. So humans could experience another hit.
They could. And once again, Bill Napier says that there's a lot of effort going into detecting potential impact threats, and which I was unaware of. In 2016, NASA established an office for detecting asteroids, coordinating responses, cooperating with emergency management agencies, and the like. This is an international effort involving telescopes in Hawaii, Arizona, Japan, Australia, and other places. The aim is to discover 90% of threatening objects down to 140 meters, which would be 50 feet, yielding a 200 megaton impact, 140 meters in diameter, by the end of 2020. There's also an operational center in Frascati, Italy, under the aegis of the European Space Agency. So there's a lot going on in terms of detecting small asteroids. At the moment, discovery is very incomplete, as we see from the fact that small asteroids are discovered often as not after they have passed us, as we've seen in some recent episodes of that.
So in the end, Joanne, do you think this research that's being done is being treated fairly?
Well, whenever you roll out a new hypothesis and you challenge paradigms, you're going to get some pushback. It's kind of frustrating when people are closed-minded or they won't consider it. So I was at a conference in Los Angeles in, I think it was 2014, and there was a speaker who was talking about the Younger Dryas impact, and he said, oh, that's been disproven. And I thought, well, no, it hasn't, because there's been several new papers on it. So I spoke up at the end of the session about that. And he wasn't very pleased. I thought, you know, that's very biased to try and tell everybody it's no longer a viable hypothesis when there's a lot going on with it.
I'm impressed by the amount of detailed studies that are needed to present a big theory like this. Joanne, what will you research next?
Oh, I've got a long list. I'll have a paper coming out with three new charcoal records for the southeastern U.S., and this is an area where there are very few charcoal records, especially those that go back 20,000 years. I'll also have the paper on the siliceous aggregates, explaining in detail about those. And then I have a paleontological study I'm working on, which is called the Telltale Tusk, where we found a dissolved tusk. Well, one of my paleontology friends has it. It's a dissolved mammoth tusk that dates to the Younger Dryas, and I hypothesize that maybe the dissolution is from nitric acid rain. So I presented this at a Greek conference in 2014, but we need more examples of that and try and codate them and try and get more focus on that. There, I also have samples from the Netherlands, from the Usalo burn layers, and I would like to do more work on those. And I think it would be interesting to research the muck beds in Alaska, because there are a lot of Pleistocene fossils and animals, trees. It's a very intriguing place to study late glacial dynamics, but challenging because of the nature of the sediments up there. There's solifluction and the sediments get mixed up. So, and Malcolm Lecomte says he has unreported evidence for a major Tunguska scale event that destroyed half a dozen Middle Bronze Age cities in the Jordan River Valley. So that apparently will be a paper that's coming out.
We're starting to run out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would say if you want to learn more about this, one good source on the internet is the website The Cosmic Tusk. And so George Howard, one of the members of the group, he posts like any news about anything to do with the onset of the Younger Dryas.
I'll check it out for sure. From Knoxville, Tennessee, we've been speaking with Dr. Joanne P. Ballard. She is co-author of two new papers published in February 2018 in the Journal of Geology. The papers advance the hypothesis that a large object from outer space in some way moved by or struck the Earth about 12,800 years ago, with dire consequences for plant and animal life, plus a major change in the climate. Thank you so much for talking with us, Joanne.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, and you can find links in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Some scientists disagree with the idea that a killer comet struck the Earth 12,800 years ago. One of them is physicist and space objects expert Dr. Mark Boslow. He is a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories and adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico. Mark calls for planetary defense, but he doesn't like this hypothesis of a Younger Dryas impact. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mark Boslow, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You've been on a lot of great programs. I have seen you myself on TV, and I know you as a pioneer of the Airbuster space rocks idea that can cause significant damage, but they're not like age-ending catastrophes. Should we worry less about big asteroids and more about smaller space debris?
Well, I've argued that we should, and I should back up. I am now retired from Sandia Labs. I retired last June, and I'm sorry, I probably haven't updated everything on the web yet. But most of this work I did when I was a staff member at Sandia. I'm now at University of New Mexico.
Fair enough. And about the idea of the big asteroids, I mean, we've seen Bruce Willis on the screen trying to fight them off with nuclear weapons. But what happens when these smaller bits hit the Earth? Why should we be concerned?
Well, there's really a couple reasons why I have argued that most of the risk, at least half of the risk, is in these small ones. One is we've discovered most of the big ones that are on Earth-crossing orbits that have the potential to hit the Earth, the really big catastrophic ones. We've discovered something like 90% of those since the effort began to find them about 20 years ago. The second reason is that my models and the models of others now show that small asteroids create an airburst that's actually more damaging than an equivalent explosion from a nuclear weapon. And in the past, most of our estimate for risk came from damage from the nuclear weapons effects literature. So we've kind of updated that in the last 10 or 15 years.
So you're one of the big names in that field, and yet you're a leading critic of the Unger-Dryas impact event hypothesis. From your perspective, what are some of the problems with that idea?
Well, I guess my first problem is I don't know exactly what the hypothesis is, because each one of their papers seems to state it somewhat differently. Their original paper was the one that Firestone was the lead author of. That was in 2007. And at that point, they were pretty loose with their definition of the hypothesis. And they said, well, it was a comet or a broken comet or asteroid that either exploded in the atmosphere or in space or hit an ice sheet. And so they didn't really differentiate among these various hypotheses, and they kind of had the bases covered. And since then, it seems to have evolved quite a bit. And they don't always state it in the same terms.
Dr. Nicholas Pinter and others published a requiem for the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis, and a year later you published another paper with arguments and evidence against it. What do you now make of the two new papers published by the same group in the Journal of Geology?
Well, I have to say I spent some time last night and this morning reading those, and I mostly focused on the areas where my expertise lies, and that is impact physics and the physics of airbursts. And to me, there's really nothing new. In fact, a lot of it just either ignores or misrepresents our criticisms. And so I didn't find them to add much, if anything, to their argument.
Our guest Joanne Ballard told us the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis has been evolving, as you say, and at one point they seemed to suggest a breakup of a space rock then started giant fires on several continents at the same time. Do you think that is possible or likely?
Well, it doesn't really make sense to me, and I and a lot of others have questioned the details of how that could work, how something could break up with just the exquisite timing for all the pieces to hit the Earth, but widely separated enough that they cause fires but do not cause impact craters. There's no impact crater from this event. And so it would have to have broken up just before hitting the Earth, but before it could spread out enough that, you know, only a few of the objects would hit the Earth. And the timing would have to be perfect. And that just, to me, kind of adds to the extremely low probability of what they're suggesting happened.
At least two of the co-authors of these new papers are not scientists, as far as I can tell. One is listed in various places as Dr. Alan West or as geophysicist Alan West, but I can't find support for either of those titles. I asked Alan West for an interview. He declined. Is Alan West's lack of credentials important for assessing the samples that he gathered for some of the earlier research?
Well, I have to say, in science, trust really matters and reputation really matters. Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. And that actually was a Russian proverb. And I think I'd kind of turn it around and I'd say something like, verify before you trust. And I don't have any verified information about Alan West. I know he's been under intense scrutiny, and there was an article by science reporter Rex Dalton a few years ago talking about his role in this and pointing out that he didn't have any background, or at least there was no evidence for a background. And I haven't seen any background that he's actually got the training or experience to do what he contributes to these papers.
Another co-author of the two new papers is George Howard. According to his online profile, Mr. Howard has a BA in political science from the University of North Carolina. George Howard has a blog called The Cosmic Tusk, and that was recommended to listeners by our guest Joanne Ballard. The Cosmic Tusk blog has a list of articles slamming you, Mark Boslow. How did you develop that special relationship?
That's sort of outside the way normal science is done. I mean, we do like to have our vigorous debates at scientific conferences. Usually they don't get personal. I don't try to get bogged down in any kind of personal insult type debate. Some people, I think, find it insulting when you criticize the science, and I think George may be one of those.
Now, Mark Boslow, you have a record of going after anti-science and climate denial. How does this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis get used by climate deniers like Anthony Watt?
Well, I know he's run a few articles about it. I don't know what his position. I don't read his blog, or I rarely look at it.
Really? I'm surprised.
But I know, so Wally Broker, who actually is probably one of the most famous living earth scientists, he's at Columbia University, and he was quoted in that Rex Dalton story saying, you know, this whole controversy with Alan West, his background, says it does feed the distrust of science. Those who don't believe in human-produced global warming grab onto it. And Wally is actually the guy who coined the term global warming back in his 1975 paper in which he predicted a lot of what we've now experienced.
I think what the deniers want to do is to say, well, look, these things aren't part of any natural cycle. We can't look at the ice ages and changing climates because, after all, it was just caused by a rock from space, and that's more convenient for them.
Well, I think Wally's right. They tend to grab onto anything, whether there's merit to it or not.
Are you aware of any evidence of a crater showing the impact claimed? And if not, could the crater have escaped our notice, say hidden in the ocean or by landing on a deep ice field like the Laurentide ice sheet?
You know, I looked at that problem. They had suggested a 4-kilometer diameter object hitting the Laurentide ice sheet. And, you know, if it were that big, it would have punched right through and made a big hole in a bedrock. And there's nothing like that. If it was a 4-kilometer diameter object that broke up into a bunch of pieces, well, it's extremely unlikely that they'd all hit the Laurentide ice sheet. And a crater that young and that big, that recent, it wouldn't have subducted. There would be very little erosion. I mean, it would literally still be steaming. The tiny little meteor crater, Arizona, is 50,000 years old, not just 12,000, but, you know, something like a factor of 4 older. And it looks fresh. It looks brand new, and it's tiny. I mean, it's many orders of magnitude smaller than what they're suggesting here. And likewise, there's an impact structure. It's buried, and it took a while to be discovered after the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary event was first proposed in 1980. But it's huge. It's a monster, and it's something like 500 times older, if I did that right in my head that fast. It's 65 million years old, 66 million years old.
You know, the media loves stories of comets and asteroids striking the Earth and causing havoc. Do you think that fascination helps keep this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis going?
I do. I mean, there's a natural human fascination, and that's good. I mean, anything that keeps people interested in science and in the sky and in astronomy, in my opinion, is a good thing. But I think both, you know, your profession in journalism and my profession in science, we have to keep everything a little bit reined in and grounded. And in fact, that is one of the things I do as chair of the Asteroid Day expert panel. So we formed this organization called Asteroid Day. And part of the purpose of this panel we set up is to get experts to make sure that everything we say, everything that goes out is from Asteroid Day, the organization has a press release or as an answer to someone's question, is scientifically correct and defensible. So I think that's really important. And a lot of what we find ourselves doing is chasing down some of these clickbait stories about the next asteroid that's going to destroy the Earth. And those seem to appear with regular frequency.
Yeah, the planet Nibiru, I think it is going to come and get us. Well, it was going to come and get us, and then the dates come and pass. You know?
I think that one may have come and gone.
Yeah. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Boslow, an expert in planetary defense against objects from outer space. And that's the next thing I want to talk to you about, Mark. Are the big institutions like NASA or the EU space program, can they reliably warn us if something from outer space is going to hit us?
Well, I think anything really big, we would have advance warning. Maybe not as much as we would like. I mean, the problem is really big things that would be big enough to take out an entire continent, say, we would have to employ some kind of planetary defense scheme and actually deflect it. I mean, that would be what everyone would hope. But that is going to take something like a decade of lead time. And we don't have a guarantee with our current resources that we would find something with that much time. The smaller ones, the Tunguska-sized or meteor crater-sized events, there's a really good chance we wouldn't see those at all. They may be coming on an orbit. They may be in an orbit that would bring them in from the direction of the sun, and we wouldn't see them at all. We would get zero warning, just like the Chelyabinsk event of February 2013.
Well, it used to be that humans were not very concentrated. They were spread all over the place. But now we have mega cities. I think that increases the chance that one of these things could strike in a heavily populated area.
Well, and it did, and Chelyabinsk did do that. Fortunately, it was only roughly 20 meters in diameter. It was about a half a megaton explosion, and it was 40 kilometers to the south of the city where that energy, you know, was transferred to the atmosphere, creating this big explosion. But it came in at a shallow angle, which spread its energy out over a larger area, so more people experienced it, but the shockwave was actually less intense. And nobody was killed. And that could happen again. But we estimate that an event of that size happens somewhere on Earth roughly once every 50 years. The next one could hit a city. Again, the probability of that is low. I mean, people are concentrated. But cities, you know, if you look at the map of the Earth, cities don't cover that much of a percentage of the Earth's surface.
And it could always just hit the ocean anyway.
Could hit the ocean. Yep, and there's also we also have a concern of tsunami, airburst generated tsunami, and I've worked with tsunami modelers to try to estimate how bad that would be. Right now, I don't think we've come to a full consensus. There are a lot of people that I think have come to dismiss that idea. I'm not so sure it should be dismissed yet. I think there's still work to be done.
On a personal note, Mark, you turned a private property fight with off-roaders in Colorado into an important new argument, I think, in climate, and that is, talk to us about the right to radiate.
Okay, well, I did blog about that, and it's an idea I've had for some time, and really, it's kind of a libertarian argument, and I know it's funny because a lot of the people who reject the science of climate change don't reject it on the basis of science, they reject it on the basis of what they want to believe. And I think a lot of libertarians or, you know, more conservative people with libertarian ideas, their values want to reject it because it would require some kind of government intervention, and they tend to be sort of against government regulations. So my idea is to kind of get around that libertarian resistance by saying, geez, you know, we have private property rights. And the way we actually cool ourselves, whether it's our private property or the earth, is we radiate heat into space. It goes up into space, and some fraction of it just keeps going and disappears, and that keeps us cooled off like a cooling fin. But greenhouse gas pollution gets in the way. It absorbs that radiation, and it actually turns around and radiates it back at us. But we've established an easement. An easement is a right-of-way, and that's part of private property rights. So my argument is, well, you could sue the polluter for taking away your private property rights. And in the United States, that's a constitutional right. The Fifth Amendment says you cannot take private property for public use without due process. And there's been no due process in that. So it's kind of a constitutional argument that I think would appeal to libertarians if they thought it through.
And what are you working on these days, Mark?
Well, mostly proposals. I retired in June. I've been very busy. A lot of what I've been doing is public speaking and writing, spending time with my family. But I did spend the entire week last week writing a couple proposals for modeling airbursts on Mars and on Jupiter. And I hope at least one of those gets funded, because I'd like to work on this problem again, but more from a planetary science perspective and maybe a little bit less from a risk perspective, planetary defense perspective.
Why would it matter if there's an airburst on Mars?
Oh, there is a mission to Mars that's going to be launched, hopefully, in May, if everything goes right, the InSight mission, and it's going to have a seismic detector, a seismometer on it that would detect impacts and airbursts. And so I'm very interested in the way airbursts couple to seismic waves and actually couple through the air as very low frequency infrasound that might be detected by this instrument. And if we can model this correctly, and if everything is successful, we can get an estimate of the impact flux, how many of these small objects are out there hitting Mars.
I think that's a cool place to leave it. We've been talking with physicist Mark Boslow. He's a technical advisor. He was a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories before retiring. And he's an advocate for planetary defense, as you've heard. You can find more links and more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With our ability to find events from many millions of years ago, it should be easy to say whether a comet hit the Earth just before humans developed agriculture and civilization. As you have heard, it is not easy, and scientists do not agree on the results. I spend a lot of time trying to resolve the truth about the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis. I did not succeed, but I did find lots of worthwhile things to explore. Some things not raised by either of our guests, so here you go from just a few of my notes. First, as Mark Boslow says, trust is everything in science. I checked out our guest Joanne Ballard. She went through the right training with very good advisors at the master's and doctorate level. Those advisors specialized in subjects helpful to the two new papers. Joanne is a genuine scientist. There's a long history and deep cultural fabric running below this whole topic, and sometimes it interferes. Humans have held a mythology or even religious belief that matter from space drives major events on Earth. Science agrees with a big asteroid ending the age of dinosaurs, hitting near Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago. The whole subject was popularized by a best-selling book published in 1950, which I read in the 1960s, Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. Then in 1979, the Scottish astronomer and author William M. Napier published with Victor Klube A Theory of Terrestrial Catastrophism. Bill Napier is a co-author in the current paper and provided some of the answers relating to astrophysics relayed to us by Joanne Ballard. Richard Firestone and Alan West joined the fray with her 2006 book, The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. The science in that book has since been discounted. As you heard in our interviews, newer papers evolved in their theory of what happened. There is a group of people, mostly scientists, who are dedicated to proving comets continue to make big changes much more recently. They gather in two organizations, the Comet Research Group in the West and the Holocene Impact Working Group, which is based in Russia. Joanne Ballard and the other 29 authors of the new papers in the Journal of Geology belong to the Comet Research Group. The Comet Research Group was founded, well, co-founded, by Dr. Ted Bunch, who is a credible scientist, by George Howard, an enthusiast with no training in the field, and the enigmatic Dr. Alan West. Nobody, including science journalist Rex Dalton, has managed to find any proof of science degrees for Alan West, who took up that name only recently. I don't have a problem with citizen scientists and enthusiasts contributing good ideas and work, but we need honesty about that. By the way, I randomly checked three members listed on the website of the Comet Research Group. Dr. Sylvia Gonzalez replied she is a member, having seen evidence of a major event in her work in Mexico. Another said he is not a member per se, but has written two papers supporting the hypothesis. A third denied any connection to the group. During the interview, Mark Boslow mentioned a critical article by Rex Dalton. It's called Comet Theory Comes Crashing to Earth. It was published May 14, 2011. You can Google it or find a link in my show blog. We also mentioned the paper The Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, A Requiem, with lead author Nicholas Pinter. It was published June 20, 2011 in the journal Earth Science Reviews. The two new papers in the Journal of Geology, as I say, have about 29 authors. In my opinion, that's part of a growing disease in modern scientific literature. Science journals complain too many names are being given to add weight to a publication. There's a committee looking into that, and the abuses of adding names just to help careers with no indication of who did what work. I'm not saying that happened with these two papers in the Journal of Geology, but we have to recognize that a long list of co-authors no longer guarantees anything about whether the science is correct. I was surprised when two of the co-authors here were not scientists at all. The Comet Research Group is like a club of people with common interests in near-term impacts and coming impacts. Their Facebook page is a lively place to check out new arrivals from outer space and research into past contacts. Everything posted there seems to support the Younger Dryas impact theory with no criticism, but I found this Facebook page useful, and I'll be back. You can find a link to it in my show blog. The Comet Research Group is also a nonprofit in the United States. The main poster on their website is George Howard, a blogger at the Cosmic Tusk, the blogger at the Cosmic Tusk. The group is doing fundraising. They hope to get up to $100,000 or more to fund three expeditions to verify their impact theory. Over the past 3 months, they report getting around $35,000. For example, they would like to send members to find an impact crater, perhaps in Greenland or North Dakota. More worrying to me, the Comet Research Group is also sending out an expedition to Jordan to investigate whether a comet destroyed the biblical cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. It sounds like a marriage of mythology and religion, where comets determine human history. Of course, that is possible, but I worry about a cult-like following developing around this subject. Along those lines, the prolific author and amateur archaeologist Graham Hancock has endorsed the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Hancock claims there are many previous civilizations that were wiped out. This impact hypothesis, he says, explains what happened to them. His 2015 book, Magicians of the Gods, is based on the hypothesis. He gives credit to Kennett, Bunch, Alan West, and the gang. Graham has a page promoting the Comet Research Group on his popular website. Hanging around the fringes of the Comet Research Group are commenters who claim the pyramids and Stonehenge are all part of the human response to comet strikes. The scientists can't be blamed for such off-base comments. It's just part of the internet today. George Howard and his blog, The Cosmic Tusk, gets rave reviews from the world's worst climate denial blog, What's Up With That? Anthony Watts has run at least three pieces on the Unger Dryas impact event, and why not? It wasn't really climate change. A space rock did it. To be fair, Watts also reported on studies that refuted the hypothesis. As recently as February 2, 2018, Watts revived the story of massive fires and the comet strike during the time of early humans. So there is a continuing traffic between some supporters of this theory and climate change denial, but there is no climate denial in the scientific papers we're considering in this show. There is another small collection of scientists working on this comet theory. The Holocene Impact Working Group has six scientists who, quote, hypothesize that meteorite impacts on Earth are more common than according to current scientific consensus, end quote. Although the scientists involved come from all over the world, the group server is hosted in Novosibirsk, Russia, by the Tsunami Laboratory Institute, and that's part of the Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences. That lab also maintains an expert database on Earth impact structures. Naturally, since global interest in the strike in Siberia in 1908, the largest in recent times, a cottage industry of scientists and tourists are fascinated by comets in Russia. Again, at the Holocene Impact Site, we find some books that cover alternative history. One example is Irishman Mike Bailey's 1999 book, Exodus to Arthur, Catastrophic Encounters with Comets. But I also note a Canadian book, Tsunami, the Underrated Hazard, by E. Bryant. Remember, our space expert Mark Boslow said that a tsunami arising from a comet landing in the ocean may be possible. More research is needed, but that could be a big surprise indeed. So where do we end up, and does it matter? I say all the issues around recognizing and measuring comet impacts matter a lot. The energy released from such events is measured in terms of comparable numbers of nuclear weapons exploded. Larger rocks from outer space have already changed Earth's climate and caused mass extinctions. Even the smaller ones can do significant damage, as Mark Boslow told us. Space rocks have passed close to Earth in the last few weeks. A big asteroid is expected to come very close to Earth in 2029. As Boslow said, if smaller ones come from the direction of the sun, we will not even see them before impact. So more science and raising awareness among the public is a positive thing. That's why I did this radio program. It is strange that we can have certainty about an event 66 million years ago, but no certain closure about a strike supposedly 12,800 years ago. NASA still reports the near-Earth object community of planetary scientists say that no large impacts have occurred during the past 15,000 years. As Nicholas Pinter points out, not a single human has been proven killed by a rock arriving from outer space. Statistically, it has been quiet on that front during our human times, but how long can that last? I've got a link to a paper about that in my show blog. So we need artists and even scientists to exercise imagination so our knowledge can progress. But we also have to be very cautious about what is science and what is myth-making. One of the pillars and promoters of the Unger Dryas impact hypothesis is a leading light of science. Dr. James Kennett from the University of California, Santa Barbara, is legendary for his work. Still, as we have seen in the case of Dr. James Lovelock, scientists with vision can sometimes be very right about one thing and still wrong about another, and they may have the same passion for both. We are always going to be challenged about what is good science, and how do we keep our imaginative minds tracking with reality? Check out my weekly show blog for all the links and a new push to expand the reach of this show and its urgent message. That's at ecoshock.org. Thank you for taking this journey with me this week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Every day that we live and breathe is extended to them. They may be
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
In their attempts to delegitimize BDS, it's become more legitimate.
Yes.
For New Zealanders as a political strategy to end, Israel's apartheid and occupation.
And I think we're reaching, more of a consensus in this country about boycotts being a reasonable action to take in a context of Israeli impunity.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Sharif Sakut, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. On January 31st in Oakland, about 100 Bay Area activists and organizers gathered at the Oakland Federal Building to demonstrate in solidarity with Palestinian teenager Ahed Tamimi, who turned 17 in Israeli military detention the same day. Tamimi was detained in a night raid in the occupied West Bank village of Nabi Saleh 2 months ago, after video circulated showing her and a cousin slapping and shoving two heavily armed Israeli soldiers following an incident in which a soldier had shot in the head and seriously injured their 15-year-old cousin, Mohammed Tamimi. Outraged by a perceived insult to their occupation forces, Israeli leaders have vowed revenge against the Tamimi family and are subjecting Ahed, her mother Nariman, and cousin Noor to military trials in kangaroo courts with a near 100% conviction rate. Ahed Tamimi is one of some 300 Palestinian children currently in Israeli military detention. The demonstration was put together by the Palestine Action Network, and the following audio was recorded and compiled for the Electronic Intifada by Seja Shawashe of Arab Youth Organizing.
Viva, viva, Palestina!
Viva, viva, Palestina!
Viva, viva, Palestina!
Viva, viva,
Tamimi is 17 years old today, and her whole entire life, she has only known life under occupation. She has only known what it's like to be brutalized by soldiers.
Free Palestine.
You know, I've actually been in jail on my birthday, and I can tell you that nobody should ever be in jail on their birthday. And we remember that not only Ahed and the other more than 300 children that are imprisoned by Israel, but thousands or probably tens of thousands of kids are imprisoned right here, and that is not okay. None of them should be in prison. We say no more cages.
No more cages.
And we say free all political prisoners.
Free all political prisoners.
The U.S. has the longest held political prisoners in the world, and it is our duty to get them out. So free Ahed and all political prisoners.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
For 17 years, you are continuing to resist, to live, to thrive, even when they try to imprison you. May we all learn that even when the walls are physically around us, let us never let them trap our minds or our spirit. Thank you, Ahed. And we will stand here. And let us not also forget how many folks are incarcerated in the county of Alameda. How many folks are incarcerated right here in Northern California and all of this state. Let us fight against incarceration from Pelican Bay to Palestine.
For the Electronic Intifada podcast, I'm Sharif Zakut.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. An Israeli lawfare group tied to the Mossad, Israel's deadly spy agency, said last month that it has filed a lawsuit against two New Zealand activists for, quote, influencing pop singer Lorde to cancel her Tel Aviv gig in late December. Lorde, who is also from New Zealand, had called her cancellation, quote, the right decision. Shirat Hadin, the group behind the lawsuit, is nominally suing on behalf of three Israeli teenagers who claim they are suffering, quote, emotional injury after learning that Lorde had canceled her concert. They are seeking thousands of dollars in damages against the activists. The lawsuit is being filed in Israel under a 2011 law that allows people to sue those who call for a boycott of Israel or its illegal settlements on occupied Palestinian land. The law is part of Israel's effort to stifle speech and activism in support of Palestinian rights. In December, activists Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab wrote an open letter to Lorde urging the singer to reconsider her planned performance in Tel Aviv. Since the targeted activists are in New Zealand and were exercising their free speech rights there, it is difficult to see how any Israeli judgment could be enforced. Meanwhile, a Florida lawmaker is attempting to have Lorde's upcoming concerts in that state canceled as punishment for her cancellation of the Tel Aviv show. In his demands, Republican State Representative Randy Fine is citing a Florida law that says no state or local government can conduct business exceeding $1 million with any organization engaged in a boycott of Israel. Florida is one of more than 20 states around the U.S. that has passed an anti-BDS measure, two of which are currently being challenged in courts in Kansas and Arizona due to their unconstitutionality. Joining us to talk about their activism and how they're analyzing the various acts of political theater around Lorde's cancellation of her Tel Aviv show are Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab. They join us from New Zealand. Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast, Nadia and Justine.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So first off, have either of you received any summons or any formal legal notice that this alleged lawsuit against you is moving forward?
No, not as of yet, and unlikely to. We haven't heard anything, so we just sort of got caught up in the news cycle about them. I think it's now just kind of blown over.
So then let's break down what the motivations are. What's behind this Israeli lawfare group attacks against you? They know they can't actually enforce their agenda of censorship and legal repression. Because you're in a different country and you're protected by New Zealand's free speech laws, why would they even bother? What do you think is at the core of this kind of legal harassment?
So I've been thinking about this a little bit. I'm working on a piece that I'm writing at the moment, but I was thinking about kind of the mindset of Shirat Hadin and also the trend that they represent, the idea of... Obviously, they want a world. I think they genuinely want a world where criticism of Israel is criminalized. And in some cases, they're being successful with that. I think in cases where they're not being successful with that or in spaces where they can't be, I mean, the US context is quite different from Aotearoa New Zealand, is that they'll settle for the headline, you know, that idea that might plant a seed in someone's head that if you're going to do this stuff, it may come at a cost. I think that's probably where I'd put it at the moment, but there's probably a lot, you'd probably write a PhD on what they're up to in these kind of attempts, but I'd be interested in hearing what Justine thinks as well.
I think I've been really thinking alongside the same things as Nadia. I've been... I'm obviously not scared for myself because I do feel kind of well protected here in New Zealand. And I, as Nadia said, I don't think it's the same climate as the United States. But watching what's been going on in the States, in Florida, mm-hmm. and these moves to kind of like legally consolidate these kind of repressive laws, it's quite terrifying, really. And I think it represents a real threat to freedom of speech and to activists. Who are seeing like a kind of ramped up level of state violence and repression, to like clamp down on our activities and our ability to do kind of humanitarian social justice work.
And an escalation of tactics as well from like soft Zionist kind of tactics, which I actually think, it has backfired for them in this context. But I think that's a real, me and Justine can probably talk a little bit about this, but, you had to be in New Zealand the day that this news dropped to understand the way that New Zealanders just responded to this with absolute disbelief. I think a lot of people, it was on major news and a huge TV show over here called The Project just did a piece that was like, this is ridiculous, you know, and completely supportive of ours. They brought on a lawyer who seemed to be a sort of like a liberal Zionist. And he just said, this is absolutely what this court case is attempting to do is absolutely outrageous. And regardless of whether we support boycotts or not, New Zealand and the New Zealand government need to absolutely throw their weight behind these two women, being me and myself and Justine. And so actually, and you know, even the interviews of Shadat Hadeen that happened in New Zealand media, you could just hear even the journalists interviewing them were just thinking, what on earth? You know, this is such a contradiction to be talking about Israel as this democracy. Mm. And then to be attempting this. And I think it really, for a lot of New Zealanders, drew attention to the huge contradictions at the heart of kind of Zionist thinking.
Yeah, I think really backfired spectacularly in New Zealand in particular. I think the United States, you know, does seem to have a formal pro-Israel, like Zionist, like, you know, like hardline Zionist stance. But even in Israel, even in New Zealand, among Israel's supporters, it was like just embarrassment almost.
We're speaking with Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab. They are two New Zealand activists who successfully encouraged pop singer Lorde to cancel her Tel Aviv show at the very end of last year. Nadia and Justine, let's talk a little bit about activism in New Zealand and some of the reactions that you've gotten just from regular folks who might have just been learning about this issue through this news story that came across, you know, local media and state media. You know, Lorde is just one of many artists and performers who have either canceled their gigs in Israel or have just chosen just to skip it altogether, something that's being called the silent boycott and is sending Israel's propagandists into a panic. Even by their own concessions in documents that the Electronic Intifada uncovered last year, the BDS movement, you know, is visibly growing and becoming more popular despite the well-financed efforts by Israel and the Israel lobby around the world to curb Palestine rights activism. What can you say about the boycott movement in New Zealand? And how active are people on the issue of Palestinian rights? What have you been hearing since, you know, since this happened last in December?
So I think there's been a groundswell of support for Palestinian human rights campaigns and also the BDS movement in New Zealand. I think it's becoming more and more popular, you know, as the days go by, and especially, I mean, I talked to Debbie Abbas, and she is one of the, like, an activist within the Palestinian Solidarity Network, and she's never seen so many young people, she's never seen so many people, period, involved, interested, coming to rallies, you know, getting in contact with them. And then, and like, within the Jewish community especially as well, we found, I mean, I'm a Jewish New Zealander. I went to the local Jewish school, brought up within the community. The sort of younger generations of Jewish people post Operation Protective Edge in 2014 have become incredibly politicized against, you know, Zionism. And there's this kind of like rejection, growing rejection of Zionism among us that's really like heartening to see. I mean, for me, I haven't, it's been a long time, but, you know, I'm sort of working within the with young Jews to kind of like educate them. And yeah, so that's what, Dayenu is like a solidarity project, essentially. It's just young, it's New Zealand Jews against the occupation. And so we work with the Palestinian Solidarity Network. And it's been, it has been like really heartening to see people kind of like break ranks with the established community who won't hear any criticism, who won't even have any kind of dialogue about Israel's like apartheid regime and the occupation, and to see these young Jews say, you know what, no, I don't know who they're supposed to represent, but that's not me, and I want a space to at least talk about this. So things look good from where, well, no, things are looking brighter from where I'm standing in Auckland, but yeah, obviously I can't speak for the rest of the country or the world.
And Nadia, you know, what's your response, and how do you see the boycott movement expanding in New Zealand?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Lorde thing is a huge deal. She's a massive person in New Zealand, and not just as an artist, but I think a bit of a cultural ambassador for where we're at. So, you know, upon kind of hearing that she was performing and writing our letter, and you know, we joined a lot of other people. A lot of really great stuff came out of New Zealand. And that's one thing that I heard through the grapevine, that apparently Lord Ella had said to some friends that what really surprised her was the level of reaction from people in New Zealand. So there was some great stuff written off the bat. Like, I woke up in the morning and I'd heard the news, and there was already some amazing tweets and a couple of blog posts that had gone up pretty much immediately from people in New Zealand that I didn't actually know, you know, because you sort of, you know, the solidarity community, it's quite large.
It's a small country.
There's some people in it, but, you know, New Zealand is a small country. You generally know people who are supportive of BDS. So I think what was really interesting is that for a few people who were fans of Lore, who didn't actually know much about BDS, who had not been active in BDS activism in the past, when they heard about the fact that people were asking her to respect the boycott call and did some reading on it, they immediately understood what that meant, and they immediately thought it was the right thing to do. And I think we've been having a national conversation. So there was some of the major newspapers ran, I think, a poll saying, did Lord make the right decision? And I think it was maybe, you know, 60% yes, 40% no. But that's huge. I don't think that would have been the same, you know, even 4 or 5 years ago. I think Israel's
reputation
has really, really taken what we would call a hiding, which is like a beating, in New Zealand. And I think a lot of New Zealanders are now of the attitude that, you know, because we have that collective memory, we have that historical memory of the Springbok tour, and had that debate as a nation, is it okay, you know, is it okay to support things complicitly, as was done with South African apartheid, and the mobilization against apartheid and the boycott movement, you know, when it first started was not a popular thing, but then it came to a point where it made sense. And I think we're reaching, you know, more of a consensus in this country about boycotts being a reasonable action to take in a context of Israeli impunity.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was, I think, like, there's been a successive moments of politicization for New Zealand, for New Zealanders, which have kind of solidified this very justified negative view of the Israeli regime. And I think Lord was just sort of like, you know, the most recent and possibly the most influential one. But I've certainly watched among people who I think were undecided, or perhaps thought it was too complicated, or they saw BDS as like extremely radical and like maybe like, you know, like there was a middle ground between BDS and like Zionism, kind of realized that BDS is a legitimate nonviolent strategy. And so in their attempts to delegitimize BDS, it's become more legitimate for a lot of New Zealanders as a political strategy to end, you know, like Israel's apartheid and occupation. So I think that's wonderful.
And just one quick thing. I mean, I know we've said a little bit on this, but I think it was really interesting. So after we wrote our letter, someone from the Jewish community, I didn't know who he was. He's a writer on a comedy show here.
Dan Gurriard. It's a terrible show. Anyway, carry on.
Actually, his response letter was really interesting because it was really weak, you know, and that's from an objective perspective. I don't think there were many points made there. It seemed that New Zealand Zionists were really grasping at straws as to what they could actually say. There didn't seem to be anyone saying that Israel actually wasn't doing horrible things. It just seemed to be more of a deflection kind of strategy of, well, what about these other countries? Or, you know, we can't seriously end the occupation. It's there for security reasons and that kind of stuff. And I think...
Which isn't compelling to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not compelling. It's not, it doesn't reach out to people. It doesn't convince them, quite rightly. Yeah.
I thought also what was really interesting was the kind of very effortless and unapologetic way that Lorde canceled her show and made that decision. For years, you know, people in the BDS movement have been, you know, going back and forth and trying to get their managers and tour managers to understand the severity of what it means to break an international picket line. There's been, you know, lots of debates between the artists and activists, and they go back and forth. And it felt like this was just such an easy decision that Lorde made, that it took the Zionists and Israel supporters by surprise. And what's also significant about that, and I know, Justine, you alluded to this, is that, you know, Lorde represents this younger generation of people all over the world who are looking at Israel's policies and deciding for themselves that that's not something that they particularly want to align with. Do you see this as kind of a turning point for the BDS movement, especially the cultural boycott component of BDS?
No, I absolutely do. I see it because I think that what you're seeing is a generational divide, and I think that's why the Zionist establishments are particularly worried, because younger people, you know, live in a politicized time, and they have a growing conscience, I think, about injustice locally and internationally that was maybe kind of lacking, and that terrifies them, because this idea that all struggles are linked. I mean, there's been articles about this, just like American Zionists freaking out.
The Jerusalem Post about you say that
about intersectionality. Yeah, yes. They freak out about intersectionality because they're like, oh God, if they realize all these struggles are linked, then they're going to be anti-Zionists. And it's like, this is exactly what we're seeing, because young people have this burgeoning like conscience about these issues, and I think it's inspiring, and I'm just, you know, it just fills you with that small sliver of hope that you kind of just have to hold on to in quite dark times, and I think, you know, and I think that, yeah, their hysterical response, and it was hysterical, it was scrambling, it was mostly motivated because it was like this huge generation shift, and I saw these like young Lorde fans suddenly like, I mean, and this speaks to why it's important to reach out to, you know, like pop stars and celebrities sometimes, because they do hold a position of influence. Suddenly they were interested and they wanted to learn, and they supported us. They supported our cause once they realized what it was about. And I thought, I was super encouraged by that.
And Nadia, do you wanna chime in as well?
Yeah, I mean, totally. We are. And I think it's undeniable. And I think that's part of why, you know, when we talk about what Shirat Hadin have done, it's actually reflective of that, because I think for people in Israel who are wondering how to combat BDS, they're very concerned right now. And that's why we're seeing an escalation of tactics. And we've been seeing this for years. I mean, this isn't new, because I've been involved with the movement now for about a decade. So we know it's been something that's been going on the whole time. But I think, you know, it was like you said, Nora, there was almost like a simplicity to this, almost like things had reached a particular moment. And I think the context of Trump and the US and the Jerusalem decision were actually, you know, they were the backdrop to this. And increasingly, you know, people like Lorde had talked about, you know, because she's sort of part of, I guess, you know, she would probably describe herself as an intersectional feminist type person who's concerned about what's going on in the world. And she had said, you know, that we've got to stay informed and outraged about what's happening in the US and what's happening with Trump. And so, of course, the politics, like when you see Trump and Israel essentially against the world, and that, you know, this is something my dad's been talking to me a little bit about. He keeps saying, you know, you see that alignment so clearly. I think for a lot of people who are, you know, concerned about justice, concerned about questions of equality, it becomes a no-brainer to support the BDS movement, even in a context that is so hostile and where there has been such a smear campaign run against our movement, where individuals have had, you know, and experienced character assassinations whenever they speak out on this stuff. And that's not new. I mean, my dad was having his character assassinated when he was doing student activism in the UK in the 80s. So it's not a new tactic, but it's certainly one that they're extending. And I think that we just need to use this moment actually more than anything to keep going and keep doing stuff. And that's where we're at right now.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it before we wrote the letter. We were like, this is a moment that we, you know, we have to take advantage of to sort of raise awareness and to educate people, and like to not like speak out at this juncture would be such a missed opportunity. And I think we were quite right about that. Yeah.
Well, we look forward to seeing what else activists in New Zealand have up their sleeve in terms of engaging with and supporting the BDS movement. Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Noah Bonzi, senior analyst with the International Crisis Group, who examines the current humanitarian crisis in Syria's eastern Ghouta region, where 400,000 civilians are under siege in a Syrian government offensive. Dr. Dan Doyle, a founder of the New River Black Lung Clinic in West Virginia, who explains why there's been a spike in black lung disease among coal miners and how the Trump administration is worsening the crisis. And independent journalist Ari Paul, who assesses what's at stake for the U.S. labor movement in the Janus versus AFSCME case that was argued before the Supreme Court on February 26th. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After months of internal debate, British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn embraced a soft Brexit policy in endorsing a customs union with the EU. The announcement was applauded by mainstream business leaders, while Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May has been indecisive in laying out terms for Brexit with European leaders. In his speech, Corbyn, a longtime Eurosceptic, supported a single market with Europe, which the Labour leader insists would put jobs and the economy ahead of bogus immigration targets. Corbyn rejects the idea of negotiating a separate trade deal with the US or China, since both nations have weaker labour, health, safety, and environmental standards and regulations that would risk dragging Britain into a race to the bottom. Corbyn has also repeatedly rejected the scapegoating of immigrants and setting off one generation against another and restricting the rights of European Union citizens living in the UK after Brexit takes effect in 2 years. The murder of Slovakian journalist Jan Kuček and his girlfriend has set off a crisis for Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico, who was linked to organized crime in Kuček's last article published after his death. Links between an Italian crime gang and members of the prime minister's ruling party forced several to resign. Although corruption is a long-running problem in Slovakia, this is the first time it resulted in the murder of an investigative journalist. Kuček's final investigation revealed how criminal gangs from Italy infiltrated poor parts of eastern Slovakia and allegedly developed close ties with local politicians to exploit weak state institutions and misappropriate generous EU subsidies. Police have arrested several Italian businessmen with organized crime ties named in Kuček's last story. The investigation was launched after questions arose about why Prime Minister Fico had hired Maria Troskova, then a 27-year-old former Miss Universe contestant, as one of his assistants, despite her relative lack of political experience. The probe revealed that she was a business partner with an Italian businessman, Antonina Vidala, living in Slovakia with alleged close ties to the 'Ndrangheta, a notorious Italian organized crime syndicate. In submitting a bid to become home to Amazon's second U.S. headquarters, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel lauded his city's mass transit and infrastructure investments to lure the giant online retailer. Yet, the mayor's pledge to spend $450 million in new transit projects could exacerbate existing transit disparities for people of color in Chicago. At the same time, the state of Illinois is slashing subsidies to the Chicago Transit Authority. To address the short-term deficit, city officials hiked CTA fares 25 cents in January, a move advocates say will likely hurt already dwindling ridership. Should Chicago win its bid with Amazon, promised transit projects included in a $2.25 billion package of tax breaks and other public investments may drain already strained public budgets and further reduce the city's ability to ensure that the opportunities Amazon pledged are evenly distributed. As higher housing costs have pushed low-income residents further out into the Chicago suburbs, the CTA system has not kept up with demand. Currently, in the metropolitan area, 70% of households and 68% of jobs are a half mile or more away from high-frequency transit stops. If Amazon decides to move to Chicago, cost of living increases could well push more low-income people into areas with little to no transit access. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since 2013, 400,000 civilians living in the eastern Ghouta region, on the outskirts of Syria's capital city, Damascus, have been caught in a crossfire between rebel forces and the Syrian military. After an intense government assault on the area began in mid-February, the United Nations Security Council unsuccessfully attempted to broker a ceasefire to deliver desperately needed food aid and medical supplies to the civilian population. With a brief pause in the fighting on March 5th, a convoy of 46 trucks entered eastern Ghouta with food for about 27,000 people. But the World Health Organization reported that Syrian government forces had confiscated up to 70% of the medical supplies on board. When shelling from government forces resumed, all trucks were forced to evacuate, with nine unable to deliver their supplies. According to the UN, since mid-February, 600 people are believed to have been killed and more than 2,000 injured in eastern Ghouta after the Syrian military launched their air and ground offensive. There have also been reports of outlawed chlorine gas attacks on civilians. Overall, nearly 500,000 people are estimated to have died and 12 million driven from their homes since the war in Syria began in 2011. Your reporter spoke with Noah Bonzi, senior analyst on Syria with the International Crisis Group, who examines the current humanitarian crisis in eastern Ghouta and prospects for a peaceful settlement of the 7-year conflict.
So I think the place to start here is that it's a completely man-made humanitarian crisis. It's a devastating humanitarian crisis, but one created directly as a result of the tactics employed in this war. In this case, what we're talking about is a siege by the Syrian regime, enabled by its allies, Iran and Russia, over a siege on a rebel-held area of some 400,000. Eastern Ghouta is the biggest, most dangerous and worrisome example of siege tactics applied in Syria, but it's by no means the first. It's just the latest element of a regime military strategy that's based heavily on collective punishment, applying siege tactics, indiscriminate bombardment, and in many cases, bombardment that aerial and artillery bombardment that discriminately targets civilian neighborhoods and infrastructure, aiming to raise the price of resistance in these areas, but in particular to make conditions so bad for civilians living in these areas that they raise pressure on the rebels in their midst to surrender. And this is something that the regime and its allies have applied on multiple battlefronts in the country, especially around Damascus. And this is the latest instance. In addition to the fact that you have 400,000 civilians in this besieged area now, what's also especially worrisome about this instance is the fact that these people have literally nowhere to go. You know, previous siege in Aleppo, which was also extremely brutal, there was at least the prospect of people moving out to adjacent rebel-held areas, or in theory at least to Turkey. In Damascus, they're in a sea of regime-held areas.
Noah, the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad justifies the siege against this area known as Eastern Ghouta by talking about the shelling of Damascus, the capital of Syria, by rebel groups that they label as terrorist organizations, including al-Nusra Front and other Islamist groups who they say have provoked this siege by their attacks on civilian areas of Damascus. Could you give us the bigger picture there?
Yeah, and this is definitely it's a great question and a really important one to address, because there has been rebel shelling of civilian areas inside Damascus. Of course, the scale of that shelling is not comparable. I mean, we're talking just in the last couple of weeks, you've had more than well upwards of 700 people, civilians killed in opposition held Eastern Ghouta by the pro-regime shelling. Indiscriminate shelling by rebels of Damascus City has killed, I think, a couple dozen people. So it's extremely worrisome and deadly. But there's not really an equivalence here.
What are the prospects for some kind of peaceful settlement of this conflict, given the fact that many have characterized this war as a proxy conflict involving a whole host of nations and groups, including Turkey, the U.S., the Kurds, Iran, Hezbollah, even Israel, of course, involved in some shootdowns of Syrian jets recently? Are there any serious efforts underway to sit down at the negotiating table and hammer out some kind of agreement?
The short answer is that no, there aren't any serious efforts. There is an ongoing UN-led political process, but it hasn't made any progress over the last couple of years, and really, you know, has faced fundamental obstacles from the beginning. First and foremost, the fact that the Syrian regime has shown no interest in negotiating. And its backers, Iran and Russia, don't really see a need in pressing it to do so at this stage, especially given their overall momentum in the conflict. Russia has also facilitated, political meetings on its own turf, but again, not really. We couldn't consider them serious efforts to negotiate an end to the conflict. And you describe accurately the fact that while there's, broadly speaking, a trend of regime momentum, what we've seen in parallel is that the international aspects of the conflict have increased. Israel's gotten more involved. It's concerned about gains by the regime and Iran-backed militias near the Golan Heights. And it's also concerned about Iran building permanent bases in Syria, and it's been escalating its airstrikes to address those two things. A much bigger role on the ground is played by Turkey, which is now conducting a major offensive in northwest Syria, in primarily Kurdish territory, controlled by the same organization that the U.S. is allied with in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. is working with this organization in northeast Syria, but in the northwest pocket of Afrin, the U.S. doesn't have a presence, basically isn't backing up those Kurdish forces as Turkey is attacking them. And here, too, you have dramatic humanitarian concerns as that offensive continues. So with all of this internationalization, it's easy to see why this conflict, which was already almost impossible to resolve via negotiations before it was so internationalized, now is even harder to do so, especially in a broader geopolitical moment of such polarization and uncertainty.
That was Noah Bonzi, senior analyst on Syria with the International Crisis Group. For more analysis and commentary on the war in Syria, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Black lung disease is the scourge of miners who work in underground coal mines. Breathing coal dust can cause severe scarring of the lungs, turning lung tissue literally black, and choking off air until the victims can't breathe. There's been a recent spike in the occurrence of a particularly virulent form of black lung disease, and it's affecting many younger miners. Some doctors have theories on what might be causing the recent resurgence of black lung. One theory holds that miners in recent years have been cutting through rock with high levels of silica in order to get to underground coal in areas where thick coal seams were previously mined, which could be the cause for this recent black lung epidemic. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Dan Doyle, a founder of the New River Health Center, a black lung clinic in West Virginia's coal country. Here, Dr. Doyle, who's worked at the clinic for the past 40 years, explains what black lung disease is, how it's caused, and how the Trump administration is worsening the crisis.
From the start, it was recognized that there was one form of coal mine dust disease called complicated pneumoconiosis, or progressive massive fibrosis, identified by chest X-ray, that if present was de facto evidence establishing completely disabling black lung disease. Over the years, because of the safety measures in that law, the prevalence or incidence of that severe form of black lung disease, progressive massive fibrosis, went down, 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 down. And now in the last 10 years, it has dramatically increased again. So as the news reports have told us, just in the last 6 months, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health has confirmed almost 500 cases of progressive massive fibrosis in this region. And National Public Radio on its own has gathered reports by going out to the different clinics and doctor's offices of nearly 2,000 cases. That's unprecedented. It's a tragedy. My perspective in these 40 years treating minors as a family doctor and as the medical director of a black lung clinic funded by the federal Department of Labor, and that black lung clinic is right inside of part of our community health center, is that people who have this really, really have a bad time. And it used to be older guys, like in their 60s and 70s, who worked in the mines for 40 years. But what's really striking now is it's younger guys, some of whom have only worked in the mines for 10 years or 20 years, who are in their 40s and sometimes even in their late 30s, because a lot of these guys go into the mines when they graduate from high school and they're 18.
I know black lung disease can't be cured, but what can you do for these miners?
What we mainly do is to see them, treat what are called exacerbations. And the other thing we do is pulmonary rehabilitation which is a combination of exercise and education, which does reduce shortness of breath, increase their exercise capacity and their quality of life, but unfortunately, it doesn't make them live long.
Dan Doyle, I've read that one of the culprits is thought to be the thinner coal seams that the miners are working. Can you explain what that has to do with it?
They are mining thinner seams of coal. All the big thick seams, the ones that are 4 feet high and 6 feet high under the mountain, they've been mined out for the most part. So the companies have gone to thinner seams of coal, and it's common for miners to be working all day long in a space that's only 4 feet high. They're on their knees all day long, but they're mining sometimes 30-inch seams of coal. And when they do that, they have to cut more of the rock above the coal to get to it. And the rock is where the silica dust is, which is more scarring to the lungs. So the theory is we're mining thinner seams of coal, which means cutting more rock. The machines are more powerful so that they're pulverizing that rock into tiny particles that make it farther and deeper into the lungs. And the other thing is that miners are working longer shifts, longer days, as more and more mines have become non-union. There's kind of less protection for miners, both in terms of the hours they work and in terms of enforcement of safety rules.
The Trump administration has been dismantling many of the protections put in place recently or even decades ago in many areas. Perhaps most well-known are the environmental protection rollbacks. Have there been any impacts on miners specifically, whom Trump claims to love so much?
Always there has been a push and pull between the miners, and for many years the miners were organized in their union, United Mine Workers of America. Always there's been a push back and forth, a tug of war about what's more important, getting out the coal and production, regardless of the human cost, or getting out the coal in a safe way that protects the lives of the people who are doing the work. And in the last administration, the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration actually was a longtime coal mine safety expert who came from the United Mine Workers, Joe Maine. And during that time, there was greater emphasis on dust control. And there was a huge anti-administration campaign organized by the coal operators, referred to as the war on coal, which unfortunately many of the people here completely identified with. So now we have an administration where the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration comes from the coal industry. And characteristically, he, like many administration agency heads, sees their job as cutting back government regulation, protecting corporate authority and profits. And it didn't just start now. I mean, this epidemic of coal mine dust disease has been going on for 10 years, so it's not something brand new. For me, as a physician, more and more over the years, I've come to see that my role as a citizen activist and as a voter and someone who tries to explain things to other people probably is more important to the health of miners than me writing prescriptions and doing examinations.
That was Dr. Dan Doyle, a founder of the New River Health Center, a black lung clinic in West Virginia's coal country. For more information on the spike in the occurrence of black lung disease, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For over 40 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized the right of public sector labor unions to collect agency fees from non-union members that they represent in collective bargaining negotiations with management on the issues of job site working conditions, which benefit the entire workforce. Now, with the justices about to rule in the Janus versus Aspe case, that could change. The plaintiff, Mark Janus, is an Illinois state employee who doesn't want to pay the union fee that was established as being constitutional in the 1977 Abood versus Detroit Board of Education case. That precedent was first challenged in another Supreme Court case, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association in 2016, which resulted in a 4-4 split ruling after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, where no action was taken. The current Janus case is supported by right-wing anti-union groups and activists, including the billionaire Koch brothers, the National Right to Work Legal Foundation, the Bradley Foundation, and the pro-Trump Mercer family. Their objective is to further weaken labor, the Democratic Party candidates that unions fund, and undermine worker rights. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist Ari Paul, who assesses what's at stake for public sector labor unions in the Janus case, which was argued before the Supreme Court on February 26th.
Mark Janus is a civil servant in the city of Chicago, who is an agency shop repair in Chicago at AFSCME. who argues that it is a violation of his free speech to be compelled to pay an agency shop fee for the union he is not a member of. The idea here that the sort of coalition of right to work advocates say is that that to have an agency shop fee violates someone's free speech because you're compelling their speech. You're forcing them to make a political statement, because if you pay the union money, you are somehow endorsing everything the union says or does in public. The argument kind of against that in the that came up from the union side in the Janus case is that this opens up sort of a Pandora's box. This means that any kind of fee that anyone is compelled to pay in the public realm is then subject to litigation. For example, if a homeowner disagrees with something its local school board does this mean one doesn't have to pay property taxes? If you are compelled to pay a car registration fee at the DMV, are they somehow compelling your speech? It's sort of an argument based on any kind of payment to someone else somehow endorses everything that other person or entity stands for. But it is as shaky as a case that might be, it plays to the conservative majority's belief that they have said over the next several years that money is considered speech, and it works to their ideological stance that they would like to disempower unions. I mean, in the oral arguments, Justice Kennedy essentially stopped arguing about any constitutional issues and just scolded the solicitor from the state of Illinois to say that unions bankrupt governments, they protect bad teachers, all this sort of litany of anti-public sector union talking points, sort of just basically showing his hand that he just wants any kind of case to disempower labor unions.
Now, Ari, one of the unstated, but certainly one of the priority goals of anti-union legislation in this case now before the Supreme Court is to damage labor unions' ability to fund political candidates, particularly Democratic Party candidates. And this, as I understand it, is really a partisan fight going on here in the guise of a labor union versus corporate issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that organized labor, with some exceptions, but for the most part, organized labor is aligned with the Democratic Party, more or less. And especially on the local level, in cities where there's a lot of union density, labor unions are powerful political players, and endorsements can make or break a candidate. And so, especially in union states that are, you know, with high unionization rates, like New York, California, Illinois, labor unions still are one of the forces that keep those states blue because of their influence. In the same vein as voter suppression is very important for the political right to make sure that they can disempower voters of color in key states to advance into also gerrymandered districts to favor Republicans. We saw that in Pennsylvania very recently, but it was struck down by their Supreme Court, by the state Supreme Court. The disempowering of labor unions, it weakens the Democratic Party hand. But it's not just the ability to get behind candidates, it's also their ability to act as advocates in the workplace. It will mean if unions are living under this regime and they're losing members, that's less money for union organizers to fund campaigns, to just have an office where union staffers and members can meet, strategize, and organize. It's partly political, but it's also partly economic.
Ari, is there any way to calculate the damage and fallout for the public sector labor unions if this case goes the way we think it will go in terms of a win for Janus and against AFSCME?
Yeah, I mean, in worst case scenarios, unions have in right to work states lost. I think the biggest loss is somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%, which, depending on the size of the union, can be a pretty big chunk of change, but and also its political influence. One of the arguments that the anti-union side makes when posed with the accusation that they're not about free speech, but really just about disempowering labor unions, they said, well, everyone is perfectly free to voluntarily pay these dues, and if the union is a good one, then people will go ahead and pay. And there are unions that maintain high density rates. For example, in the state of Nevada, the state of Nevada is a right-to-work state, but the casino workers union usually stays somewhere in the neighborhood of 95%. This is, you know, touted as a sort of a success story of a union operating in a right-to-work environment. But this is where it becomes hard to calculate, because even though they're keeping the membership and they're keeping the revenue flow into the union, this means that it changes the focus of how a union operates. The organizers, rather than going out into workplaces and organizing around health and safety campaigns or for the next contract or going out and organizing new workplaces, they're simply having to go around workplaces and find new members and sign them up. It's a drain of union resources and union money. So in the worst case scenario, you lose a lot of members. But even in the best case scenario, when you keep a lot of your members, it really keeps a union overly focused on keeping members. So even if they have a high density rate, this affects their ability to be economically and politically influential.
That was New York City-based independent journalist Ari Paul. For more perspectives on the consequences of an adverse ruling for unions in the Janus versus AFSCME Supreme Court case, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Giving teachers what they want. With right-wing politicians racing to arm teachers and making schools neighborhood fortresses, one wonders, why don't let's ask teachers what they want? Teachers in West Virginia will tell you what they want, and it ain't Glocks. Since February the 22nd, teachers there have walked out demanding raises. Their demand is simple and to the point. No raise, no school. Teachers had earlier negotiated a 5% raise after talks with the governor. West Virginia Senate cut the raise out of the budget, and teachers took to the streets. It shows how politicians treat teachers as props rather than the hard-working people that they are. No raise, no school is beginning to echo far beyond the borders of the Mountain State. Workers are beginning to awaken from their long nightmares. Kudos to the teachers. Power to the teachers. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very, very powerful show for you today. In the second half of this week's show, we're going to be talking about a topic that becomes more and more urgent each and every day: fascism, learning from history, and confronting what we need to do today. We'll hear a short clip, the trailer actually, from a talk given by Bob Avakian, and the talk is called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." Now, in the full talk and over 2 hours of questions and answers, Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, lays out a compelling, in-depth, and comprehensive answer to what we're facing with the Trump-Pence regime and what we must do now. After that, we'll hear an interview I did last year with author George Prochnik on when it's too late to stop fascism, according to Stefan Zweig. In the 1930s, Austrian writer Stefan Zweig was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria just ahead of the Nazis, and in 1941 spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, A Warning to the Future. We talk with Prochnik, author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World, about the assault on the truth, the widespread idea that it couldn't happen in Germany, and we'll talk about the obvious lessons for today. But before any of that, I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Raoul Peck is the director of the new film, The Young Karl Marx. This is a film that will give you a whole new and completely refreshing and inspiring understanding of the birth and development of communist revolution. It focuses on 5 years from 1843 to 1848 and tells the story of the 26-year-old Karl Marx, along with Frederick Engels, Jenny Marx, and Mary Burns, and their fight to bring a scientific understanding to the revolutionary movement of the times. In doing so, Marx developed the science of revolution. And today, this science has been given new life by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Marx of our times, and the architect of a whole new framework of human emancipation, the new synthesis of communism, popularly referred to as the new communism. With that as a background, it is with great pleasure that I was able to see Raoul Peck's film, The Young Karl Marx, and learn about the earliest days of and battles to establish the science of revolution. Raoul Peck, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's jump into this. Why that period in particular? You're talking 1843 to 1848, and you really zero in on that. And I thought it was, one, a period that has not been paid enough attention to, but it was also something that really, it was just a very refreshing place to start. So I wanted to ask you about that, too.
Yeah, well, it was a very difficult choice. I mean, to be frank with you, throughout the different drafts of the screenplay, we basically started from Marx as a 12-year-old student in his gymnasium school to his time in exile in London when he was 32, 33. But little by little, we focused on the period starting in France or a little bit before in Germany when he's expelled, because somehow it's the most interesting and intriguing moment. That's where the ideas are developing. And that's where the first step are taking in organizing the working class, the non-existent working class until that moment. Because, of course, most of the head of the movement, especially the utopian socialists, those were hand workers. You know, they were tailors, they were woodworkers, they were, you know, they were not workers, you know, that were working in factories. Mm-hmm. So Marx and Engels come into that, you know, juncture and changed everything and gave it a structure, gave it a theory, and even an approach, a more, I would say, educational approach. Because for Marx, as they say in one of the scenes, you know, ignorance never helped anybody. So you need to know who is your enemy and how do you fight that enemy, you know? So it became almost natural to tackle that moment that is not really well known, because people always try to go to whatever monument of Marx's writings, and specific the Capitol. The Capitol is somehow the, I would say, the mother work, you know, where he tried to put everything that he has accumulated over the year, you know, because his approach was to be a scientific one, you know, so he needed a book like this. And that's why it took so much time to write. But the evolution of the ideas, the beginning and also the energy of the youth was important to us. You know, when he said, you know, philosophers, have spent time analyzing the world when what it needs to be now, is to do now, is to change it. This is a phenomenal decision at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking of that. In fact, you know, one of the things related to that is the opening scene to the film really does set the tone for much of the rest of the film. The fact that the ruthless oppression and the struggle to change it. Let's talk about that opening scene, because that's something that really sort of set me back in my seat when I saw that.
Well, it was necessary to show from the beginning the type of violence we are talking about, you know, and blind violence that doesn't make sense. You know, and somehow it's at the core of the, I would say, the reaction of the young Marx, because he's somebody who could not accept inequality and justice and repression. So, and as a journalist, because at the time that's what he was basically. And I love that scene as well, because first it shows you the violence of the time, that these people in the wood, trying to survive by taking wood on the soil, you know, on the bottom of the forest, and those forests belongs to a rich class, and even that they were not allowed by law to use, and this totally contradiction, because that when Marx writes, well, if the people don't understand the justice of the law and why and the absurdity of this, so they cannot obey those same law and they are bound to revolt, you know. And in a philosophical aspect and political, this was the best beginning I could have, and you can see from that moment the evolution of Marx and then Engels together.
Mm-hmm. And it really gave something to me. Go ahead.
No, and then visually, of course, that was important, because I knew that the rest of the film, we would not have very much space and room for any, action situation, because they were basically, it was an intellectual fight most of the time, until, you know, the 1848, where they wrote the manifest, the Communist Manifesto. Yeah. So it was important to, you know, to date the moment and to show visually and even in the body, you know, what kind of violence we are talking about in that moment in the Western world.
Yeah, and it gave you a very, very sharp sense of the nature of capitalism. When you're looking at this thing, and the point you make in that scene is the attacks on the people who are simply going out and trying to get wood, gather up wood that they can sell in order to survive. And even the dead wood on the ground is verboten. It's very heavy. It's very heavy when you look at that. It's and that's why they're getting killed, because they had the audacity.
Yeah, and very symbolic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you this, and this is, you know, and again, I keep thinking too. There's so much in terms of what you did with the film, in the early years of Marx, and the portrayal of Marx and Engels, and you know the people involved in there. It was an incredible piece that brought to mind constant things, including references to today. And I had to say, you know, there's a lot of parallels to the world today, and still many of the same questions and issues are posed for all of us, especially when you think about, you know, the immigrants coming into work and the, you know, what's happening to people now. Let's talk about that a little bit, because the social and political crisis there that existed then has been magnified a million times over now.
Well, that was the idea. You know, how do I provide tools to young people of today to understand what's going on? because those last 40 years, you know, we have had so much incredible changes, but changes that did not bring us much more clarity. On the contrary, it blurred everything. You know, before the end of the Berlin Wall, you could still say, well, there are two sides of the world, and one being the capitalist side, and the other one being the so-called communist countries. So, and at least, you know, coming from the third world myself, you know, I could pick my enemies and my friends, and I would not follow to death, you know, whatever Moscow or any party was telling me. On the other hand, I knew how to protect myself from the action of the Western world. You know, in Haiti, the 35 years of the dictatorship were basically supported by the United States, you know, and as was many of the coup d'etats in the Latin American continent. So you tend to have, to be suspicious toward any kind of hegemonial attempt. So when that changed with the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, it's as if capital have won, and then you heard, you know, people like Fukuyama saying, well, it's the end of history. So it's a matter to say also there is no more class struggle, you know. So, and then you add to that, you know, a place where little by little, you know, we, through concentration of the press, through the deconstruction of many institutions or many organizations, you know, the union were attacked very violently during those last 40 years. And then you come up in a time where we are now, we don't even know what real news is and fake news is. Mm-hmm. So I feel we end up in a place of ignorance that is very hard to, to react to. You know, what do you do as an artist, as a writer, as a filmmaker to counter that? Because it's not something you can deal with in a matter of one project, one film, one book, or 1 year. It's really how do we will face the next 30, 40 years. That is what is at stake.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the world like we know it, you know, the capitalism is undergoing an incredible transformation. And as usual, it's going to take time before we can even recognize toward what we are going. Mm-hmm. What we only know is that there are limits to everything right now. There are limits to the energy we can have access to. There are limits to how much food we can grow. There are limits to even how much we can continue to destroy nature, you know, mm-hmm. and all those things. And we know there are limits to the sort of inequality we are in, you know. How far more can you go when you know that 1% of the people own more than 80% of the riches of the world? You know, how far more can you go? You will say, well, 0.2% have 90%, you know. So we are getting into absurd situations. So we know that change is happening right now, but we can't really recognize it. So again, to come back to my film, sorry for this long contextualization, is my attempt, it's a modest attempt to at least deliver some sort of theoretical tool, some instruments to understand what's going on. You know, I'm not sure that, well, I can say yes, I had tremendous impact in discussion in many of the countries where the film came out, you know, in France, in Belgium, in Germany, and I can see how motivated young people were in their discussion, and I hope it will be the same here too. But it's about, you know, how do we regain our capacity of analysis, you know? How do we reverse this permanent growing ignorance about things? The individualization of all any groups, you know, we lost our collective, you know, and there cannot be a real change without a collective, without, you know, our collective minds
and ambition for change. So the film is just, you know, how to give the people the capacity to think again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Raoul Peck. And the name of the film is The Young Karl Marx. It's a film that's coming out all over the world and all over the country. All right, so don't miss this film. That's really important, and I think it's related to this next question, because one of the things that you do, you know, that you present is you present actually a lot of what you're talking about, the social and political crisis that of today. It's treated today with evasive rhetoric and strict adherence to the boundaries that are set by the system itself. And what you bring out in relation to Marx and Engels and the whole movement that developed at that time is that there's a whole lot going on that actually needs people, particularly like when you look at the role of youth, the role of women, the importance of actually the revolution of thought, challenging everything about the accepted norms and then daring to forge a new understanding and a new path, which is really important. It's a constant challenge to the accepted knowledge. And I think that's – and then on that basis, what are you going to do about it?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the minimum, you know. And we – but unfortunately, we got engaged in this acceleration of everything where – you know, people and young people are being bombarded with all sort of information, sound, images, and ignorance as well. You know, a lot of products are circulating that have no single atom of reality. And so how do you counter that? You know, because one thing we know, we cannot fight if we don't have the right information. You know, otherwise we are bound to do a lot of mistakes. We are like blind people fighting in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one question too, and I know our time is running up, but I wanted to actually get a couple more questions in. One is Proudhon. And I thought that was a really amazing, really great way you handled that. Because Proudhon actually, one, it showed the broadness of mind that Marx and Engels had in terms of reaching out to people like Proudhon, who they had differences with, but they also had a lot that they thought they could bring along. But then there was this point where Proudhon walked up, and the friend that I saw it with, we both saw this, and both being familiar with Marx's work about the philosophy of the poverty of philosophy, when he walks up and he says, "Here's my new book. I think you'll enjoy it, and it's called the Philosophy of Poverty." Really, kind of, it was like, "Oh, it's all gone now. It's all gone down now." Let's talk about that. That was a great move. That was a great scene.
Well, you know, it's a real story, and between the two, you know, they have been playing cat and mouse for a long time. And, of course, Marx was at the beginning. He did respect Proudhon. You know, he's like Marx is a very peculiar character. You know, he was very impatient when he felt like you were not progressing like you should do, you know, in particular with great thinker. So he did recognize the importance of Proudhon. And he did respect him quite a lot, but at some point, he felt like Proudhon was being lazy and was not, you know, going further than the space he already had, because Proudhon was already very famous at the time in the movement. So, and he understood, you know, as, you know, the younger son is all, you know, at one point has to kill his father in order to emerge. You know, somehow this is what happened. And because that's one of the aspects in the film where I had to find a way to even explain what Marx's position was, you know, as somebody who wanted to install a more scientific socialism. You know, and the two great movements was on the one side, the more utopian socialist and the like Proudhon, and the more populist socialist like Weitling, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was the perfect character to show, you know, what exactly Marx and Engels are going for. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course I play with the comic situation of it, because again, I'm making a film. I'm not writing a thesis.
Right.
And because, you know, the hardest part for us, Pascal Bonitzer and myself, you know, when we were writing is, you know, how do you tell a very powerful and interesting story and keep the attention of the audience, but without inventing things that did not exist, you know, and keeping very – a very faithful line to really what happened and to the character. You know, we didn't invent one single character who did not exist. Mm-hmm. You know, we, of course, we set aside certain people, you know, like even Moses Hess, who was a very important historical figure. You know, that was, we had him on the first scene in the newspaper in Cologne, and then he disappeared in the film, although we had scenes that we cut out. But Moses was a very important figure. And by the way, he was one of the father of Zionism, you know, later on in his life. And so we have a lot of character like this that we did not exploit, but we made sure that every character in the film did exist. And we researched, and we knew exactly who they were, what they represented, and where they were in the story at the time.
Mm-hmm. One question here now is that you know, and this is something that was really important to me, that one of the things is the point that was made continuously throughout the film is that these are not laws of nature, but laws of man. And they're laws of man-made relations of production. Things don't have to be this way. They're because there's a certain way the society is organized that they are this way, but people need to step up and change that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, starting with Hegel and then Feuerbach, that's the fundamental issue. It's like men make history. And that means if man makes history, that means they can change history. And that's the fundamental importance of that.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, in a time like this, you know, you would really hear a lot of people who are totally discouraged. You know, they are discouraged against politicians. You know, yes, they are all corrupt, and they are discouraged against even the democratic process of vote. You know, they don't go to vote because, well, it's all rigged and it doesn't make sense, etc. So it's really important to make understand that whatever the situation is, only we can change it. You know, only it's the addition of our strength and our resistance and our engagement that can change anything, you know. And the history of the workers have shown it, you know. Nothing that we have today in terms of democracy, in terms of process, was the result of somebody handed it to us. It was always the result of fight, of people dying, of people organizing. You know, whether it's the independence of America, whether it's the Civil War and the freedom of the slave, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it's the feminist movement, the right of vote to women, the right of work and protection in the workplace, everything is the result of fighting and of people understanding their situation, coming together, fighting together, and imposing the changes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we are losing right now.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that ends up in the film with the towards the end of the film, the argument, the struggle to actually produce the Communist Manifesto that would unleash the world in a way that had never been seen before, unleash the people of the world in a way that had never been seen before, which I thought was really a really important part of it.
Exactly. And if you remember, by the way, today is the 170th anniversary of the Communist Manifesto. And if you read it today, if you read the first chapter at least, it's exactly the description of what happened in capitalism today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's totally present and current. You know, what he says about the capitalist without, you know, without the brakes that is invading the planet, you know, that there is no limit and that it will go crisis after crisis and destruct a lot of institution, et cetera, et cetera. So it is exactly what is happening today.
And including in that the summons to all people to stand up and stop this, which I think is really, really important.
So, of course. Yeah, and because there will be no magic.
Right.
And even worse, if you rely only on your anger or on any revolt, that's the best way to do even more damage. Because that's one of the things that you have in the scene with Weitling and Marx, where Weitling is almost saying, well,
everybody is angry enough, and we can even use people, criminals from prison, and put them in the street to change the system. And Marx said, no, you know, you can't do that. You need to educate the people. They need to know why they are fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's exactly. So organization is as important as the knowledge of the situation or the anger that you can have. You know, it's like, let's take the Trump voters, you know. Yes, they are pissed. Yes, but what is the reaction? They are voting for a man that is totally on the other side and that will even damage them more, mm-hmm. you know. So that's totally blind. So you also need to organize and have discussion and really refine your strategy. You know, changing the world means work as well. That's another point that I want to make with the film. You know, you see those young guys, you know, they are in their 20s, but they spend a lot of time also reading, writing, thinking, arguing, discussing with others. You know, it's not just, you know, writing a tweet or writing on Facebook and saying you are angry. That's not enough.
Right.
You know, like the civil rights movement, people risk their life. They put their strengths together. They had to discuss. They train themselves, you know, and that is what is needed today again, unfortunately.
All right, Raoul Peck, thank you very much for a great film, and thanks for the interview, man.
Okay, thank you.
Great Bye-bye. Talking with you. Take care now. Bye. All right, that was Raoul Peck, director and co-writer of The Young Karl Marx. Now we're going to go right into Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the trailer of a talk he gave last October called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world is possible." And folks, if you want to get this, and I recommend that everybody go get a copy of this, download it, listen to it, spread it around to all your friends, go to revcom.us and you'll find it there. That's revcom.us. You can also find it at refusefascism.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people, acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that without exaggeration threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program? Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system, whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, and the talk was a trailer from a talk he gave last October. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. The video of the entire one-hour talk is available at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Cats like me and you have got lost, but they adhere to laws outside the laws and say down by those we don't subscribe to. The world is getting stranger.
All right, welcome back. That was Revolution by the Pretenders, and we couldn't ask for a more fitting song given the world we're faced with today. George Prochnick is an author and writer for The New Yorker, and shortly after the Trump inauguration, he had a piece in The New Yorker called When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. Now, in the 1930s, Austrian writer Stefan Zweig was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934, and then he was in exile in 1941. He spent his final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, what he called a warning to future societies. He had learned firsthand what it meant to not take on fascism when it first arose. Quite a horror. And so without any further ado, let's jump into the interview that I did with George Prochnick just the other day. I interviewed George Prochnick. He's a writer, and he has an article in the February 6th edition of the New Yorker magazine. And his article was When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, and according to Stefan Zweig. And he wrote this, and he said, he looked at in the 1930s, Stefan Zweig, as I said earlier, was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934. He was in exile, and in 1941 he went into exile in the States, in the U.S. He spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, and the memoir was a warning to the people of the future. All right. And he had learned firsthand what it meant not to take on fascism
when it first arises, what the consequences are. So without any further ado, we're going to listen to this interview I did with George Prochnick just a couple days ago. Check this out. I recently read a piece in The New Yorker. It was a very powerful piece, and it was called According to Stefan Zweig, and it was by George Prochnick. When I read it, I thought, I've got to talk to George. I've got to have him on the show to talk about this because it is such a compelling piece and it's such a necessary and important piece today, given what's going on in the world. So I'm really happy to welcome George to the show. George, I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and for what you said about the piece.
Well, let's jump into this. You recently wrote a piece in The New Yorker about the Austrian writer Stefan Zweig and his memoir, The World of Yesterday, that he wrote in the summer of 1941. Tell people who Zweig was and why his memoir was so significant that you felt you had to write about this.
Well, Zweig was an affluent Austrian Jew. He grew up in Vienna at the height of its cosmopolitan glamour. He himself, from a very early age, decided that his vocation was writing and was successful immediately. He began writing poetry, then he was writing essays for newspapers, and everything that he did found an audience. He began then writing extremely popular short stories, political essays, eventually histories, a novel, biographies, a libretto, a play. Everything that Zweig did added to his worldly acclamation, and he saw himself, because he became so popular, not just within Austria, but in fact worldwide. And at the pinnacle of his career in the mid-1920s, he was the most widely translated author in the world and quite possibly the most successful. He saw himself as representing all the values of humanism that he hoped the historical trends were going to affirm more and more as his life went on. The first, of course, terrible blow to this dream was the First World War, which shattered the original Habsburg Empire balance between different ethnic groups, which was a vexed balance, but one which, at least for a period of time, kept the worst aspects of prejudice and ethnic denigration in check. After that war, Zweig decided that more important to himself than being a celebrity author would be the project of doing what he could to promote tolerance, international humanism, etc. And even though he continued to write at an extraordinarily prolific rate, he spent even more time, arguably, organizing different conferences, giving talks, trying to bring together the leading humanists from everywhere, from the East as well as from the West, to talk about what could be done to ensure that the catastrophe of the First World War was not repeated. So throughout this time, leading up to the rise of fascism in the late 20s and early 30s, before Hitler actually came to power, Zweig felt that his own situation, despite his grave concern for other more vulnerable populations, that his own situation was relatively immune. And, of course, after the Nazis came to power and eventually Austria as well, later in the 1930s, became threatened and collapsed and fell under Nazi rule, Zweig found himself suddenly among the refugee population that he had watched with compassion and with a terrible sense of premonition, dating way back to after 1933 when Hitler became chancellor. So after he himself left Austria, he went to England and then he went to the United States and eventually he ended up in Brazil. But in the United States, he did the bulk of work on his memoir in the summer of 1941, living in, of all places, a small town up the Hudson from New York City called Osnig. He lived in a house, a very modest house, not like the grand apartments and grand hotels in which he had spent most of his life, very close to Sing Sing prison. And he worked furiously on this memoir because he wasn't trying so much to preserve a record of his private existence. It says virtually nothing about his own domestic life. What he was trying to do was to look at what had happened to his generation and understand how even someone as privileged as himself, let alone the millions, without all the buffers that he had thought would barricade him against the worst effects of fascism, how those had all fallen away. So the document, what he ended up producing in an incredibly rapid rate, he was sometimes writing several hundred pages in a shorter period as a few weeks. What he ended up producing is this extraordinary, I guess we would say, almost a record in real time of how a civilization which had seemed so secure and so invested in its progressive democratic values could have collapsed so utterly and in a relatively short period of time. He really tries to look at this, and I am convinced, having spent a great deal of time with this book, that there are lessons which are sadly very pertinent for us today.
That was one of the really important points that you made in this article. This whole idea of even the title of the book, The World of Yesterday, and he's speaking to an audience that clearly it's not an audience that was necessarily living in the time that he was writing about and was actually looking to the future. And if he actually could conceive of a future given what was going on in the world at the time and what the future might be. But that whole idea of speaking to people about what actually, this is a warning. This is a warning to the future. And I thought this, the point that he made is that it's a law of history that contemporaries are denied a recognition of the early beginnings of the great movements which determine their times. If you look throughout history, that has so much importance in seeing how things develop and how things get to the point that they get to.
That's absolutely correct. Everything that you just said. First of all, in terms of the book as a message to the future, I think he literally conceived of it as a kind of message in a bottle to the future. He knew that his own generation was going to be immersed in, as he said, the abyss and unspeakable hells for as long ahead in time as he himself at the age of 60 when he was composing this could see, or 59 and about to turn 60. But at the same time, he didn't think that the Nazis would ultimately destroy the planet. What he felt was that if there was anything that he could give to allow the next generation to rebuild civilization on sounder grounds, that there could be no higher mission he could take on. To your point where you mentioned how it's denied to contemporaries to see what will become the great or the most important movements of their time, this is something that Zweig very, very poignantly presents. When Hitler first began to make a name for himself, which was in the early 1920s, nobody took him seriously because he seemed a buffoon, uneducated, so crude and ultimately unlikable that the elite, the intellectuals, couldn't imagine that this person would ever become a threat to the entire German, Austrian, and ultimately global culture. You know, there's another scene that I think of in this context. This son of the writer Thomas Mann, Klaus Mann, who was also an author, described having seen Hitler early on at a Munich tea house. And he's watching Hitler stuff his face with these cream puffs, and he's, as he puts it, such a petty bourgeois pig and so nasty and so, in a visceral way, not a leader, not a figure who seems capable of inspiring the urge for greater German glory or let alone any kind of preserving any ideals of civilization. He says, this man can never be a threat to us. And he says, it's impossible. And I think in our own situation here, it's obviously the case that Trump had been around for many years in the public eye. No one who was in a position to stop him understood for a very long time that he might be capable of channeling some sort of mood of a large swath of the country that could ultimately sweep him into power.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You know, one of the things that comes up, too, in your piece, and I thought it really made me pause, because at the same time as what you're talking about in terms of Zweig and what he began to understand, when he actually was out there, at one point, he even ended up applauding the Nazis for their ability to bring, I think you say, a renewed sense of passion and import to German elections. And I kept thinking about the whole idea that somebody can get in there and mix it up, and really the idea is to get people, set people's heads on fire, and then you can actually get in there and wrestle with some things. But this was a fairly stunning thing to see somebody who did care the way he cared about what was going on, and then at the same time to be sort of blindsided by this whole point of the Nazis had an ability to bring a renewed sense of passion and import to the German elections.
I think that's a very important point. And again, there are certainly people who looked on, who continue to look on. I've seen this phrase in a number of relatively mainstream conservative essays and sites now, but the idea that, well, what this president is doing is acting like a bull in the China shop. You know, we had a huge problem. Something had to happen. He's there. He's going to shake things up. And there's this almost sly little winking, joking sense that they're going to know how to rein this force in at the right time. And historically speaking, the idea that you can control a charismatic maverick at the moment you decide it's gone too far has just been disproven time and again. And I think we have to be very clear that the passions the leader can excite, even though those passions may have different motivations and be from all sorts of different demographics with different goals in mind, they don't in any way validate the larger platform on which a charismatic leader runs. The passions may be real and sincere and have positive elements. That doesn't make anything that the leader himself represents something that we as a country can abide by.
And that's extremely important. I mean, again, you look at what's going on today and think about this. I mean, all the things that we got in the build-up to the election where it was like, look, the people from the Rust Belt are really coming forward. And it was this whole people who haven't voted, people who've been so alienated from the system. Mm-hmm. And finally, they found their hero. And when I'm reading your piece, I'm thinking, damn, it's like way too much. There's way too much similarity here.
Right. There were so many reasons to be skeptical that he would be a hero of those demographics who felt forgotten, disenfranchised, etc. I mean, beginning, of course, with his vast wealth and his notorious lack of generosity as a human being in every sense. But he said what people wanted to hear. And, I think another point that Zweig makes, though, that's relevant, because it's obvious that that vote of the Trump's words, that, the forgotten man, that mattered. But another thing that Zweig points out about Hitler's ascendancy, the moment when Zweig himself, began to take Hitler seriously, was when he realized how much money was being spent on the different squads of young men that he saw training in these towns along the Austrian-German border. They would be driving new trucks, wearing these spanking new uniforms, and all very, very well healed in their appearance. And he realized that there were financial interests using the nascent Nazi Party as a front. And there was unquestionably also a great deal of moneyed interest behind Trump, and that shouldn't be lost sight of. And moneyed interests who have, since the election, however they voted, come to decide, well, maybe this can work in our favor after all. I mean, a friend was telling me recently of a friend of his who is involved with a hedge fund that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the initial weeks after Trump's election. Obviously, there's this enormous rally on Wall Street. So there has also been an acceptance of the more heinous, from the point of view of human rights, actions taken by the administration. I think, unfortunately, because the greed of people with money is so far still being gratified. So it isn't only that this one population found its hero. It's that another population found someone who would allow them to become that much richer and, in fact, increase the very socioeconomic inequalities that in some way made this president possible.
Now, let's move into this, because you say in your piece that Zweig recognized the crucial role of propaganda in eroding the conscience of the world at the time, and this was a massive boon to what Hitler was trying to do. Let's talk about that, because there seems to be a lot you can draw between that situation with Hitler and Trump.
Well, absolutely. One point that Zweig makes is that at the outset of the First World War, it was still possible for a poet, for an intellectual, for an eloquent voice to intervene in the clamor towards war and make a statement that even if it didn't halt the progress towards war, would at least cause enough of a controversy, enough of a dissension within that rush into bloodshed, that there was some hope that you could affect the course of history by sufficiently articulating the dangers of what lay ahead. But over the course of that war, what modern propaganda, what we think of as modern propaganda, really took hold and saturated all forms of media, not just print media, but radio as well. And Zweig documents to an extent how the very capacity to exaggerate the fear of strangers, the dangers posed by foreigners, became a self, not just self-perpetuating, but an expanding, snowballing phenomenon, so that by the end of the war, Zweig actually labeled what the press was doing as the doping of excitement, that there was just a need to produce a certain kind of effect on readers or listeners so that you would continue to have what we would today call an audience share. By the time the Second World War was becoming more and more imminent, Zweig says that the organization of lies, which is how he describes propaganda had become so effective that it was no longer possible for anyone to say anything that could have the slightest effect on the rush into the madness that that terrible war became. And there were so many eloquent statements in the period leading up to our own election period. I think of Michelle Obama's rightly celebrated speech at the DNC convention and any number of other instances that if it was possible for words to matter to the whole population, they would have mattered at those moments. And unfortunately, it's obvious that our segmented news, our ability to curate our own news feeds through social media, our lack of any common standard of truth has led to a situation in which propaganda is now seen as by one side or the other, and I would argue infinitely more perniciously on the side of the right, it is now viewed as just the situation with news. You're looking for an affirmation of your opinion, not for some sort of a factual report. And in that situation, I don't know how you find common ground again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. Well, one of the things, too, though, that is very, very important in relation to all this is the fact that propaganda has that other role, which is, as you point out, is both actually whips up Hitler's base. That's what it did in Germany. It whipped up his base. And it covered for some of the most brutal things that he was doing as he was consolidating his hold on power. And that people actually didn't see the truth. They were blurred into wishful thinking. Truth was blurred into wishful thinking, even as all these terrible things were going on.
Absolutely. The combination, as you just said, of how propaganda can hide from people what's actually going on and stir sentiments to encourage the worst excesses. We've seen that. And we've also seen the last point that you made about how in a situation where everything feels so chaotic and dangerous, any gesture towards normalcy becomes something that people just grasped for desperately. And there was that long period in the run-up, both after the election and the period leading up to the election, when I felt as if Trump had only to not do anything awful for 24 hours, 36 hours, and you have extraordinary statements on the part of CNN where it began to sound as though this was a clear indication that he had converted and become just like any other politician. It took so little for people to want to project so much onto any sign that things were not going to be as disastrous as many people feared.
I have two more questions for you, and one is a question that you pose in the article, which is how far along the scale of moral degeneration Zweig would judge America to be today under Trump?
Well, I think that one heartening phenomenon here has obviously been the strength of the resistance to all sorts of different measures that have been promulgated by the White House. That has been the marches, the boycotts have shown that the population is hardly subdued. And there are lots of positive signs of people's understanding that this has to sustain itself and build momentum. One thing that is clear about Trump's character is that he is capable of being thrown off balance. And I say only slightly tongue-in-cheek that I wish that some of the energy of the Occupy movement might turn into a pre-Occupy Trump movement. And I think this could take all sorts of different forms. More boycotts, strikes, obviously marches. Every possible effort to disrupt his own effort to give a veneer of everydayness to what is in fact a radical politics. So that's the good sign. I think in terms of where we are with news, where we are in terms of doubts about the checks and balance in our government, what's the sweep that the GOP had on every level, not just in terms of Congress, but in terms of the governorships, et cetera. Things are a lot rockier, particularly because the GOP has shown itself to be so absolutely spineless. The point that Zweig makes is that you can have that particularly dangerous equation of eroded shared values and eroded institutions. And things might still not tip all the way over until something catastrophic happens. In the case of Germany, less than 30 days after Hitler became chancellor, that was the Reichstag fire, the burning of the parliament building, which the Nazis blamed on the communists, and which there remains some doubt about today as to whether that might not in fact have been set by the Nazis themselves. But regardless, once that happened, Hitler immediately imposed a raft of emergency measures that shut down justice entirely. And what I worry about here is the big event, whatever form it takes, or the fabricated big event, but something that becomes an excuse. And we've already seen Trump manufacture terrorist incidents, manufacture the threat posed by different demographics in ways that could really spin things very quickly into a different place than we find ourselves in today.
Mm-hmm. Now, you answered a good part of my next question, but I'm going to read what I was going to, the last sentence in your article, and you can comment on it. You say the excruciating power of Zweig's memoir lies in the pain of looking back and seeing that there was a small window in which it was possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly and irrevocably that window can be slammed shut. That's sort of what you were just talking about now, but it's also something that really needs to be emphasized because, frankly, I'm really happy to see all of the resistance that's out in the streets, and we need, you know, there is a need for a whole hell of a lot more. There needs to be millions of people in the streets, millions and millions, that to actually speak to the towering, you know, horrible situation that exists today. But I thought your last sentence really puts out a very sharp warning to people, a small window in which it's possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly it can be slammed shut.
Thanks, and I agree with you that what's happened so far, there needs to be more of it, and unfortunately, there's not going to be an opportunity to tire of it. This is not something that is going to go away quickly. In a best case scenario, I think there's a fight here that's going to have to be waged for a long time, and it's been heartening to see that enough Americans have. A spirit of defiance of injustice, that they're willing to break up the routines of their own lives and speak out against what's going on. But we need more of it, and I really hope that the different groups, not only vulnerable, but different groups with different kinds of privilege, can find ways of resisting together, because it's only in a very powerful and relentless co-resistance that we're going to keep that window open long enough to actually get these people out of power.
All right. Thank you very much, George. I want to really express my appreciation for the article and for coming on to the show, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with George Prochnick. Now, George is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. And he had an article in The New Yorker titled, When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to remind listeners that the entire talk by Bob Avakian, the Trump-Pence regime must go, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world is possible, is available at revcom.us. You can also find the link on my Facebook page. And go to Fandango, or your favorite movie site, and find out when you can see The Young Karl Marx. I want to thank all the people who worked on this show this week. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with what has become one of my favorite songs, The Voice of Revolution from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.